The Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. We presented a spreadsheet on Thursday, and because of some revisions in fiscal notes that we've received, there are some small changes, and so we do have a new spreadsheet. We did not make 250 copies like we did of the last one. We trust that those of you that got one already have it in your little folder, and you will take out your pen and make the changes as you hear them read off. We do have some for those of you that might not have gotten a spreadsheet. And for all of your mental health, I want you just to remember that the spreadsheet will be online after our committee meeting. So with that, why don't we hand out to those that need them the new spreadsheet?
Kids got screwed.
If you can just raise your hand if you need a new spreadsheet. Okay, I think everyone has a spreadsheet that wanted one. Why don't we turn it over to Mr. Albrecht to go through the changes? Only the changes will be highlighted.
Madam Chair and members, before we go through the big spreadsheet, at your desk should be a paper that looks like this that says Healthcare Access Fund Unofficial Statement. On the top, and at the very bottom of that sheet, on the line that says balance, if you look at the last two numbers there, that is what, according to the Office of Management and Budget, is the projected deficit in the Healthcare Access Fund after passage of the GAMC bill. And relating to those numbers, I would like to direct you to, on the big spreadsheet, this one, on line 33 on the first page, if you follow that all the way over and look at the last number there for fiscal years 12 and 13, you'll notice that the savings in the Health Care Access Fund after everything is said and done in this bill is $409,621,000, which is about $103,000 more than the currently forecast deficit in the Health Care Access Fund. When the spreadsheet was put out last week, there were some coding issues with the way the MA expansion was coded on the supporting pages of the spreadsheet, so that at that time it showed that there was no impact on the Health Care Access Fund, but that was a mistake on my part. Looking.
I think there's a question about the Health Care Access Fund, Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, and thank you. Mr. Albrecht just mentioned that because of the passage of the General Assistance Medical Care Agreement, it almost made it sound like that's why the numbers look the way they do it on the bottom line. Is that why it goes from $200 million in 1 year and down to $59 million? Is that why is it going down so fast?
Well, Senator Coring, there was money in the GAMC bill taken out of the Health Care Access Fund to pay for it.
To the tune of how much?
48 million, we believe, was one-time money. There also were changes made to the Minnesota Care program so that the fund would be in balance for the rest of this biennium. Otherwise, it might not have been.
And if I can ask another question. So on the fiscal year 11 column on the very bottom, it says $59 million, so I could really add another $48 million that you're saying that was taken out of there.
No, this sheet that was handed out was with incorporating the changes in the GAMC bill.
Okay.
And the big spreadsheet is incorporating changes that are made in this bill that are the recommendation of the chair. So you can see that we are in good shape. Any other questions about the Health Care Access Fund? All right, then let's go on.
Madam Chair and members, the other line that I directed you to on Thursday last week is line 22, the non-dedicated revenue to the general fund, which is $361 million in this biennium. What I didn't say last week was that a substantial portion of that revenue is a transfer from the Health Care Access Fund to the general fund, where we are transferring the savings from the MA expansion in addition to the savings in the Health Care Access Fund that are in this bill in this biennium. The total amount of that is $218.3 million. Another large portion of that total of $361 million are the various surcharges. They are about $108 million. And the other major, or I should say large, amount of money involved in that surcharge is about $31.6 million, where the TANF fund is being used to pay for the current general fund cost of caseload growth in the child care programs and a portion of the current biennium's expenditures for the working family credit. There aren't many changes in the subsequent pages, but if you go to page 4 of 18, where it says tab 1, page 4 of 18 on the bottom. On lines 179 to 186, these are the items for funding the child care caseload growth and the working family credit. Those numbers are a little bit different than they were on Thursday, and they are also in different years of the biennium. That was because I did not understand entirely how what we were doing in the bill was supposed to be reflected on the spreadsheet, but this does reflect the language of the bill. On page 7 of 18, on lines 344 to 363, this is all of the activity, basically, that reflects the MA early expansion. And I believe on Thursday, those net amounts on line 344 for the TAILS were substantially different. And that is because at the time, I hadn't shown the amounts of the savings from the MA expansion separately. The net result on the overall bill was not affected. It's just that the net result on these numbers changed. And then on page 8 of 18, the next page on lines 427 to 429, this was not on the spreadsheet on Thursday. The fiscal note for this proposal came in over the weekend and was incorporated into it. It has tail savings. It's an intergovernmental transfer for Hennepin County and Ramsey County to do a demonstration program, I believe, with a population similar to the GAMC population.
I think it's for all public clients that they might have. And this was authorized in the health care reform bill at the federal level. And these hospitals have agreed as a part of that demonstration to do a voluntary intergovernmental transfer. An intergovernmental transfer, members, is when we have them in law now. It's when an organization transfers money. Generally in the past, it's been Hennepin County Medical Center, transfers money to the Department of Human Services, and the department uses it then to leverage medical assistance dollars, and then they send those dollars, both the local share and the federal share, back to the provider to implement whatever program they're being asked to do.
The new spreadsheet.
Madam Chair, are we going to go through the language of the bill? I have questions on this section that I wanted to ask about.
Yes, we will when we get done with the spreadsheet. I just wanted to mention that that language is in the bill now because we finally got a fiscal note. And I guess that's all. Are there any other questions about the spreadsheet? If not, is there a motion to adopt the spreadsheet? Senator Lori will move that the spreadsheet be adopted. Senator Prettner-Solin.
Madam Chair, can we amend the spreadsheet once it's been adopted? There are questions in the actual bill that I have, and I would ask that we wait until we go through the bill before we adopt the spreadsheet.
All right, but we need to adopt the spreadsheet before we can adopt the bill language. Let's turn to the bill language then. I have just a couple of other things to point out to members of the committee. There is on pages 51 to 53 and 58 to 61 some language relating to licensing changes resulting from a Court of Appeals decision that are included in Article 3. This was requested by the Department of Human Services in response to the Court of Appeals decision. It has to do with allowing people that have been denied set-asides of the right to appeal the decision. Then there also is a section of the bill, Article 2, on page 47. It was part of a bill that we had hoped to get savings on, but we never did. But some of the language didn't cost any money. It has to do with the waivers and whether or not you can have more than four people under the roof of an apartment building in order to be able to receive a waiver. You know, this would allow that. That is what the current interpretation of the law has been up until this year. And then the other thing that is that you will find in Article 4 on page 65, the MERC funds are not reduced in this bill, but there is $150,000 of the MERC funding for the University of Minnesota Academic Health Center that is earmarked for a program for foreign-trained physicians. It turns out that we have several hundred foreign-trained physicians living in the state of Minnesota. And in order for them to actually be able to sit for and take the test to become a licensed physician in Minnesota, they would have to start medical school all over again. This internship program would allow them to complete an internship at the University of Minnesota and then be able to enter the residency part of the medical school curriculum. And it would mean that we would have several hundred physicians that would be able to become practicing in the family practice area within a couple of years instead of a long period of time that it normally takes a person to go through medical school. Are there any questions about these items? If not, if there are questions about other items, we would take those questions at this time. Senator Pretner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I'd like to say I think you've done a phenomenal job in putting this together.
Thank you.
In light of the crisis we're facing in state funding and everything, and I know that you've made an effort to alleviate the pain as much as possible. I do have some questions about some of it, though. And on the first page regarding the surcharge on the HMOs, my concern is that I see this as something that governor will attack as being a tax. And I'm just wondering if we could hear from anybody from the HMOs and see if they support this.
Is there anyone here from the HMO Council or any of the individual HMOs that would like to testify or answer questions? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Catherine Kmit. I'm from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I'm happy to answer any questions.
I think the question was, do you have any concerns about the HMO surcharge that's included in the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, we do have some concerns about the HMO surcharge. It falls unevenly on different health plans. It applies only to their fully insured business, which health plans have regular commercial business as well as government programs. Money, in turn, comes back to government programs in the form of increased rates, but each plan has varying amounts of government programs as well as commercial business products. And so we have some concerns about that. We also have concerns, as you referenced Senator Pretner-Solon, about the governor's position on this, and is this a viable resource or revenue source for the funding of this bill?
Well, Ms. Schmidt, I would just say this much. These are Medicaid dollars that we know we can get, as opposed to Medicaid dollars that are being booked in the governor's budget that we don't know for sure whether we'll get them yet.
I understand.
Madam Chair?
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Ms. Schmidt, there's a compensation for the HMO surcharge, though, too. Does that not adequately satisfy you, I guess?
Senator Berglund and members of the committee, I haven't had a chance to look at this language really carefully, but it looks like the surcharge would be 1.45%, and I think it's in another part of the bill as to what the increase would be. As of Thursday, I believe it was 1.28% rate increase, so it's not an equal, we raise it over here, and then the rates get adjusted in the same manner.
Well, Ms. Schmidt, that's because half of the money stays with the state because it comes from the federal government. The rate increase is only designed to give you back your share.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, nevertheless, it still affects the, it's not an even exchange. And again, back to my earlier point about how it's going to affect different health plans differently based on the makeup of their business through their HMO.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
I know that the health plans have had one of their most profitable years in this past year. It doesn't seem like a very hard sacrifice to make in light of the fact that providers are taking cuts and hospitals are taking cuts and every other program in the state is making cuts at this time. It would really help us if the HMOs and the health plans could support this portion of the bill. I'm very concerned that the governor not be lobbied to veto this portion of the bill.
Well, Madam Madam Chair and members of the committee, we are also very concerned about the fiscal condition that the state finds itself in, and we are very impressed with how you've developed this bill, Senator Berglund. We are also taking many, there are a multitude of different rate reductions and withholds also included in the bill. This is not just one provision. I understand what you're saying. We would like nothing more to be able to support legislation that will resolve the budget gap and expand the Medicaid program so that more people can qualify. How we get there, though, there are some of my plans that have concerns, and so that is a reality. It just will affect different plans differently. Nevertheless, we stand ready to work with the committee members, with the chair, with you, to do our fair share and address the budget gap. Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Schmidt. I guess I just wanted to follow up and speak to that issue, elaborate a little bit on that issue, because we have states around the within the United States looking at some of the things that are available to us from the federal government. And Minnesota has the opportunity because a lot of what we've already done with healthcare reform and also just kind of because of some improvements that would help our state to take advantage of some federal dollars that we could give away to other states or we could be using here within our state to help offset the impact of the downturn in the economy and some of the cuts that we're having to make. We had a proposal brought to us at the beginning of session that the hospitals overall put together. And while not every single hospital was on board, as a whole, they understood the dilemma we were facing, and they were willing to take small losses in some areas. As you said, there was a bit of a disparate impact in order to help us find some additional money to deal with our problem overall, and also to help offset some of the the burden on some of the hospitals where they have a high percentage of population where they're not being paid as high a reimbursement rates as they would be in other ways. So by working together and by what Senator Berglund has done to look very strategically at how we can deal with these budget issues, we can provide better reimbursement rates overall. We can cover a population that the proposal that's in place right now, the hospitals around the state are just telling us isn't even workable for them, which certainly affects our economy. So I guess I would just echo, I really hope that we can all come together to take advantage of this opportunity rather than looking at only at an individual bottom line or even looking at something politically rather than what's in the best interest of our state.
I think we have another testifier.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm here representing Preferred One today. Madam Chair, in response to Senator Pretner Solon's question, and in light of the conversations that you and I have had previously this year, Preferred One would urge you not to adopt this provision. And Senator Olson, I understand your plea, and it doesn't fall on deaf ears, but the money that's being taken out of this surcharge is not the health plan's money. This is money that comes from premiums paid by individuals and small groups that get their coverage through HMOs, and that's one of the reasons that we would urge you not to adopt this. This doesn't impact the other parts of the business, and one of the reasons that it falls disproportionately amongst different plans is that this doesn't cover the insured market. And you've heard us talk about the insured market, the self-insured market, and the HMO market ad nauseum over the past 10 years and longer. And that's one of the faults with this provision. The reason that I'm here today to talk about this is that the disparity falls particularly on my client, Preferred One. It's a small plan in the hundreds of millions of dollars of premiums rather than in the billions of dollars of premiums that we compete against. And in fact, if this surcharge is adopted, it will put my client below their reserve requirements for risk-based capital and will have a similar impact on another small plan and other plans in the future. And we understand
that. Isn't that because Preferred One chooses not to contract with the state for public business?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Preferred One, when it entered into its HMO license, which was then a CISN license, did so, as I described for the committee last week, because it came late to the game, was having a difficult time getting started, and to go out and try and contract with providers when we were having only public business as our first line of business was not an option. At the time that the state was trying to move into its prepaid medical assistance program statewide, we worked with the Department of Human Services and another health plan to try and make sure that you had a choice of plans in every county. We were able to use our network to help you get to that area to try and cooperate with the state and work in ways that would make it possible for the state to save money and to have a budget that it could forecast that was a stable budget, unlike the one that we had in the old days when we didn't have prepaid medical assistance. And every year you came back in this committee and tried to find money to meet the forecast that kept going up and down. Madam Chair, you're correct. We have not had...
Just because you chose not to start your business by including yourself as a bidder for the public business doesn't mean you couldn't change your mind and do that today, is it not?
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct, although trying to compete in this market is not an easy thing to do. And it's not as simple as simply filing and saying we want to open the doors for business. We also are trying to keep a business that is in the positive margins, and when you try and go out and deal with a group that pays the way that medical assistance does, the way the general assistance medical care does, it doesn't make for a positive way to contract with your providers.
Mr. Griffith, under this bill, there will be no general assistance medical care.
Madam Chair,
it will only be Medicaid
and
Minnesota Care. Are there other questions? Senator Coring?
Thank you, Madam Chair. How much money does this surcharge generate?
In our bill, it's about $20 million. I think the House bill is more than twice that much.
Can I ask another question?
And it is deposited in the Health Care Access Fund in this bill.
I don't know. What's the difference between a a surcharge and a surtax. Is it the same thing? Or
Senator Coring, just to give you a little 101 about taxes. Taxes are something that the citizens of the state of Minnesota pay. And the government levies how much they will pay. A surcharge is a mechanism for generating more federal dollars into our state budget. And the citizens of the state of Minnesota don't pay any more.
Where do federal dollars come from?
They come from the federal government's budget. And I think we heard testimony the other day that most other states in the nation under these fiscal times have been looking to generating more federal dollars to help balance their budgets.
Right. I pay federal taxes.
Well, I don't think this is going to cause your federal taxes to go up. Senator Olson.
Well, and Madam Chair, as a state legislator, I guess our responsibility is to do the best that we can, as other 49 states are doing, to look at our overall tax picture. And so I guess it seems to me that if I were running for a federal level position, I might be out there talking about federal taxes. And it's not that I don't appreciate that we pay federal taxes, but if we don't balance our budget and other states are using federal assistance, then all that's going to happen for Minnesotans is we're going to have higher state taxes or property taxes, and we're not likely to have lower federal taxes.
Senator Coring, I think another thing and members of the committee that we need to remember is that at least to date, we really don't get our fair share of Medicare payments from the federal government. So if we get a little more Medicaid, it's just maybe going to help us to create a little bit fairer health care payment system from the federal government.
I thank the chair for schooling me.
You're welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just would add that for the people who have current coverage under our insured product in our HMO, under your definition, they will be receiving a tax increase because that surcharge won't be coming back.
Well, Preferred One has a choice. If they want to become a part of the Medicaid delivery system, they can choose to do that, and then they will get an increase in the Medicaid rate that would offset this.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that. I would ask the committee members to take a look at the chart that you and staff have shared with us that shows how the money is returned to the plans under this surcharge scheme, and there are plans that do very well and there are plans that don't do so very well. This is not a fair tax system, and we would urge you to try and adopt something else. I know that the committee has a great deal of business before today. I don't want to belabor the point. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you this morning.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, Mr. Griffin, I'm trying to follow your line of reasoning. So you're saying if you don't participate in the public programs, you're at a disadvantage. But you're just commercial, and you're saying that this is going to cut into your profits significantly. So are you saying that those who participate in public programs are the ones that profit? I mean, that have a higher, that they're the ones that have a higher profitability than those that are just in the commercial market?
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm trying to show that there is a difference in terms of the money that's being returned to plans, which is dependent upon the book of business that they have in public programs. Some of them do much better than others. Based upon where they are in rate cells and where they are in terms of geographic reimbursement. It doesn't fall evenly. The program is not fair, and that's the difference that I'm trying to make. And I would draw a little bit of difference in terms of the way it's being phrased. We do participate in public programs. We have a joint venture with UCARE. We've had a contract that we entered into at the time the state needed to move into this program statewide to meet the 1115 waiver requirements. And we believe that we do participate. We have made contributions to the program, and those don't come without emphasis. We'd be happy to work with you in talking about where our plan's profitability has been. We are a nonprofit plan. We are owned by two hospitals, Fairview and North Memorial, and a group of physicians. So it's not a group that's in business to make money and take that money into profit shares, but it is a very competitive market, and it's been very difficult to keep the plan going.
One last question,
Senator
Madam Chair.
Solon.
Mr. Griffin, have you thought about what would be a fair way to assess the plan so that we could come up with a similar amount of money?
Madam Chair, Senator Pretner Solon, I don't have any brilliant ideas that make this easy. As we have made our decisions and our plan, the urging that we have made to legislators and to others in the administration is one that is not easy to look at, but we suggest that you use a mechanism that falls across the entire spectrum of business, and that would not be using the plans that are just in the insured market.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then hopefully we'll move off to section. I know that's what you're thinking about. But Senator Pretner-Solon, and I have lots of statistics and paperwork to pass along to you about your question regarding profitability between commercial and PMAP. And I passed out a lot of that information related to my bill that's on the table. So it does, according to the reports that the HMOs and health plans report, there is a significant difference between profitability between the commercial products and the PMAP. Most of the commercial products are losing money. PMAP has all sorts of plus sides.
And members, I will just mention that this in this bill, this money goes into the Healthcare Access Fund. I also will just mention that since the last forecast, just in the last month alone, we've had 1,000 more than were forecasted enroll in Minnesota Care. So we do need to be mindful of the financial health of the Healthcare Access Fund, which all of that money goes back to paying for people that are in health plans.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Pretner-Solon.
Madam Chair, on page 18, it talks about the Hennepin and Ramsey County pilot programs, and I'm wondering why this is being limited to just those two counties, and if there's a chance. I see there's a savings to the state, and I'm wondering if, I just think St. Louis County is one of those where it could help in developing one of these. And we already have significant integrated systems in St. Louis County. I'm just wondering if other areas could be included.
Senator Pretner-Solon, the federal health care reform bill allows states to participate in this total cost of care payment mechanism with public hospitals. And the bill limits it to public hospitals. This bill, however, also allows accountable care organizations to be established outside of public hospitals. And that language is also in the bill.
Madam Chair, SMDC's Millard-Dwan Hospital is as much a public hospital as Ramsey is.
Well, you have to go get the federal government to say that, and then you would be able to be in this pilot project.
Okay. I have another question.
I guess Michael Scandrett had sent a note up to ask to say.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm sorry I didn't get up fast enough on the previous issue, but I am sorry that I also need to drag on a little bit longer the surcharge question. I'm here on behalf of the state's county-run health plans, county-based purchasing plans. And unlike the previous witnesses, there is nowhere to shift the cost to private purchasers. And the county-based health plans only do public programs, and they're operating at a slim margin. In fact, some are even below the acceptable margin, are working to bring their premiums up. So the effect of the bill is actually to tax the counties, and the counties don't have the money to contribute to subsidize the county-based health plans. So we'd request that the chair and the members of the committee could work with the amounts to be sure that it isn't a net loss for the county-based purchasing plans, because they, again, don't have anywhere to shift the cost to, and the counties don't have any money to subsidize those further. And so we are at a point where some may actually not be able to stay in business and or may lose some counties from participation in their plans.
So, Mr. Scandrett, we believe they come out whole.
Well, Madam Chair, we haven't had a chance to review all the language, but from looking what's in the summary, which is all we've seen, it looks like a net loss for the county-based purchasing plans.
We don't believe so.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, be happy to work with staff to make sure we understand that, and if the intent of the committee is to not have a net loss, then we'd greatly appreciate that and want to work with you on the
It's
language.
Easier with the county-based purchasing because they have no commercial insurance.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Senator Prettner Solon.
Madam Chair, on page 22, I would like an explanation of why I believe this applies only to Regents Hospital, why they would get a 25% increase in their reimbursement to physicians while everybody else is getting a 1.5% decrease.
Senator Prettner Solon, that's because of the great losses that they take in their clinics.
Madam Chair, what is the explanation for that? Why are they getting such a great loss in their clinics?
I don't know, but they have shown us the information that would justify this rate increase.
Madam Chair, could we get an explanation from somebody from Regions that it just doesn't seem a fair increase without some justification for it?
Well, I don't know if there's anyone here today who would like to testify on this issue.
I mean, Madam Chair, everybody operates under the same rules, so I don't understand why that would occur. Madam Chair, I would actually like to move to remove the first sentence in starting on 22.31 and ending with the period on 22.33.
Let's take the testimony that you asked for, Senator Prettner Solon.
Madam Chair, my name is Shantara Hardy. I'm here for Regents Hospital. I will not be able to talk to the specific portion of the bill, that's for the health partners. I'm here representing Regents Hospital. That's for the health partners clinic. But we'll be able to get you that information before the end of committee so that you can have that. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner Solon, if you were going to make that motion, doesn't the rest of that paragraph have to deal with that as well? Would the rest of that paragraph make sense to stay in there if you eliminated the first sentence?
Madam Chair, I would defer to counsel on that.
Madam Chair, members, that whole paragraph should come out as one thought.
Okay. It would be the chair's recommendation that that language remain in the bill. Any other questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, on different topic.
Be fine.
Two things. One, on page 92 of the bill, I just wanted to comment on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program Enhanced Administrative Funding. Just to say that I think that there are opportunities across the state within local jurisdictions to help families that are in need access those dollars. And I think there's the need is out there, and anything that we can do to help those families access those funds, I think will be very helpful. And secondly, on page 99 of the bill, the COBRA carry forward, it's 99.25 is the line item. And Senator Berglund, I think, do we have some, it troubles me that there's unexpended dollars in the COBRA funds now. I'm happy to see that we're able to maintain those and use those going forward, but do we have, are you confident that we're doing everything that we need to do so that, again, those individuals that are eligible for those COBRA dollars are getting access to them?
Senator Lynch, when this, which is envisioned as a short-term program because it's piggybacking a federal law, when it was set up, there were instructions that this information was to be distributed through the workforce centers where people are applying for unemployment, and those would be the people that would be most likely to be eligible for this.
Madam Chair.
I have a point of order. We're on a we have a motion. Yeah.
I did not hear a motion being made. I heard a question about whether
she made a motion.
Madam Chair, I'll withdraw the motion at this time.
Okay.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I would just say it's been my experience with individuals in my district that the COBRA dollars, the people are interested in seeking those and in assistance in that regard, but I'm not yet confident that we are doing everything that we can do on a statewide basis within those workforce centers to make that information available to those that might be eligible. So I guess I would just, on the record, like to say that if there are things that we can do within those workforce centers, I think that's an area that could be further improved.
Senator Lynch, it's a little bit difficult because they are not included in our budget, but I'm sure there's someone here from the Department of Human Services that will take the message back. I'd like to see more aggressive efforts on the part of the workforce centers to inform people who might be eligible for the COBRA piggyback program.
Thank you.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And I just, on this question that Senator Prentner-Solon had, I guess my question is where would this language have come from? Is this a bill that somebody introduced, or was it, what's the origin of the language?
Senator Coring, it's just part of a lot of different financing pieces that have been incorporated into the bill.
By the chair.
And they've either been heard in relationship to this budget or in relationship to the GMC bill. Language has been forwarded to all of the members prior to this meeting. Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not sure if I understand this going back to this same language, because we've had an overall explanation that we had last Friday about the need for increases and reductions, and we've talked a lot about how we are reducing here in order to capture money somewhere else. And we've seen spreadsheets and so forth as far as how that impacts all our hospitals. Now, this particular language doesn't, Senator Prentner-Solon said this is regions only. Doesn't say that in the language, but is that just because of the way that it's written so that it will only apply there? Or
Senator Olson, it doesn't just apply to them. It applies to any clinic that's owned by an HMO.
Okay, so, but Madam Chair, we never discussed that, and I don't know if this is a particular, revenue way of offsetting something or if it's just simply singling out a particular entity or two for different treatment, in which case I would think we would need to hear why it's more difficult than anyone else that would be similarly situated before we could make a decision like that, because and also, Frank, you know, that needs to be pointed out to the committee, since it apparently wasn't a bill, that we should have had some testimony about that.
Well, Senator Olson, we just had someone come up and was asked to testify, and they said they'd be getting back to us. I don't know if there's anybody else here that would like to testify, but if there is, you're welcome to do so. questions, Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question, excuse me, follows Senator Olson's line of thinking. Then, could we get a list of the organizations that this language would target if it's beyond regions? Could somebody identify the other organizations or HMOs that own clinics?
Senator Erickson Ropes, I don't believe at this time that there are any other organizations that own clinics, but if there ever would be, it would apply to them as well.
So Madam Chair, to clarify, and back to Senator Prentner Olson's question, then this is, I'm sorry.
Senator Prentner Olson. Yes.
I'm thinking.
I guess there is someone else that'd like to testify. If you'd like to hear him, maybe he can help answer your question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Barsh, representing Health Partners in Regents Hospital. I wasn't here at the beginning of the meeting. I was over in the House, but I understand there's some questions about this language. I'd be happy to answer them. Generally, if people have them, maybe I'll just start with background based on what I know. But it is a rate increase that would apply specifically to professional services billed by clinics that are owned or operated by any HMO. I think to the question specifically right now, the only ones that I know of are Health Partners clinics. Although, to be honest, I'm not sure with the relationship of Medicare in South Dakota whether or not they would apply. I believe the reason for this is, as you look throughout the bill, there's a number of provisions that increase or decrease rates, utilize other mechanisms in order to draw down federal match. In those proposals, there is a very variable impact on organizations across the community. This was one mechanism in which you could offset some of those impacts in order to balance out across the community. But if there are other questions, I'd be happy to answer them if people have them.
Are there any questions? Senator Prentner Solon.
Madam Chair, Mr. Barrich, can you explain why that variable rate impact exists?
Madam Chair and Senator Prentner Solon, I think if you look through a number of provisions of the bill, there are either rate increases or redistributions throughout. Most of those are done as part of a way to increase or maximize the participation from the federal government and how we can get through this budget problem and move on. Throughout all those scenarios, there is, as I mentioned, a variable impact based on how those play out. This is one way in which one part of our organization might be able to be recognized for some of their work, while in completely separate pieces of the legislation, there may be impacts that go the other direction. So they are not related, but they have impacts that may work in the opposite direction.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prentner Solon.
Mr. Barrich, I don't understand. I realize that HMOs are affected by a surcharge and hospitals are affected by a surcharge and physicians are getting a rate reduction, but I don't know how those interactions might affect you differently than anybody else.
Madam Chair and Senator Prentner Solon, the only reason it impacts us differently is because we are all of those things. So we're a hospital, we are an HMO, we are a clinic system. And so we're impacted by all of those different things, while other entities are only impacted by one.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prentner Solon.
Mr. Barrich, or two, because physicians also are part of integrated systems. But all of those are separate. And so I'm not sure why that impact would be more severe on you than anyone else. I mean, your HMO is not supposed to be subsidized by the hospital or vice versa.
Madam Chair, Senator Prentner Solon, you're correct. But I think in each instance, how the mechanisms that deal with hospitals work there are often disproportionate impacts on certain hospitals versus others. The provisions that deal with HMOs, there are disproportionate impacts on some HMOs or others. The same would apply when you're talking about rate cuts or other changes to rates for professional groups or physicians. And when you look at our organization across the board, this is one way to offset sort of that totality. So no, it is certainly not meant to be, and nor does it mean that one is subsidizing the other. It's just trying to take a little more global perspective.
Madam Chair,
Senator Prentner
Solon. I'd like to renew my motion. and until we can get a better explanation of what that interaction is, because I'm not hearing really how that impact is more severe for one entity than others in the state.
Senator Prentner-Solon, do you want to state what your motion is?
My motion is to remove on page, I'm sorry, was that, what page was that?
22.
On page 22, section D, or what is that?
Paragraph D.
Yeah, lines 22.31 through 22.36.
I would speak against the motion. Is there any further discussion? Yeah. Senator Sharon.
I would just, it's very difficult for me to grasp the implications of pulling one segment out like this. Can you explain to me how what you're experiencing would be different than what ISJ Mayo Health System, that has physician clinic practice and hospitals all in their system? Why ought your organization have this 25% and them not, when there already is a difference in the reimbursement rates for these programs from the rural to the metro area?
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, I think the difference is our clinics and our HMO are the same entity. And so unlike the systems that you reference, the provisions that deal specifically with HMOs are the same total revenue stream that our clinics are. And so unlike those other systems, the impacts that are in this bill that specifically affect HMOs affect the same entity that are our clinics. That is the difference. Our clinics and our HMO are one corporate entity. It's not a relationship. Regents Hospital is a part of our family of organizations, but it is not the same corporate entity as our HMO. Our HMO includes both that health financing perspective and the clinics are part of the HMO. That's why.
Senator Prentner-Solon, I need to inform you that your motion is out of order because we haven't moved the amendment yet.
Okay. Madam Chair, do we have a fiscal note on this provision?
We know what it costs. Is that what you mean?
Mm-hmm.
$2 million. So maybe we could go through the rest of the questions and then we could get around to having the ability to move the amendment.
Okay.
Are there any questions? Any other questions? Senator Prentner-Solon.
Madam Chair, on page 78, there is the provision that we had in the GAMC bill about providing 110% increase to four hospitals. And I'm just wondering what our goal is here. And doesn't this conflict with our Medicaid early buy-in? Why do we have this provision also?
Senator Prentner-Solon, there was an error made in the GMC bill that passed, and this is correcting it. But if our provisions pass that would repeal GMC, this would be repealed as a part of it.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. On page 105, the bill begins to discuss the appropriations to resolve some of the issues due to the state-operated services cuts. I'm noticing that the language is changed and does not articulate the $600,000 specifically directed to the Mankato Area Crisis Center. And I'd like to understand why that was eliminated. I am concerned, I will just preface that by saying that I'm concerned that without that direct clarifying language towards the crisis center, that that the state-operated services will solve other problems with that money and create an agreement with the crisis center in Mankato that is so restrictive as to make it difficult for them to achieve the objectives. including resolving a problem that they did not make apparent to us about the lease agreement that they have with the Crisis Center building in Mankato is about $100,000, just under $100,000 a year that will continue to be a responsibility of the state even though they're closing that Crisis Center. So they will have these problems to try to resolve within the context of funding the services for the crisis services in our area. So I'm interested to know why we've broadened the language to just a general sum of money, which leaves a lot of discretion, I think, in a system that it will decide how to distribute this money in a way that I haven't trusted the conclusions that they've come to so far.
Senator Sharon, there's direction on the spreadsheet for the department about this.
And that will, and thank you, Senator Berglund, and that means that that's, they have to operate within that direction.
That would be my understanding. Are there other questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I have a number of amendments. Do you want to discuss those at this time, or do you want to wait until adoption of the bill?
Pardon me?
On amendments, do you want to hold on those until
yes,
you adopt
we
the language?
Yes, we need to answer the questions so that we can actually move the document before it can be amended. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'd just like to say for the record the same concern that I have on with the 110% increase to particular facilities. I understand on the one hand the rationale for the fact that people are, that these facilities are dealing with a high percentage of low-income people. On the other hand, with the early, with the early enrollment into Medicaid, we're going to have better reimbursement rates. The reimbursement rates as a whole are higher than they are in rural communities, in spite of the fact that in many of our rural communities, hiring specialists, getting people to come and actually work in some of the more rural areas of the state requires them to pay a higher fee to the doctor than is having to be paid.
So, yeah. Senator Olson, I think maybe you didn't understand what I said. This is a technical correction to the GAMC bill. But if the early buy-in occurs, the early buy-in includes repealing the GAMC bill. So this language also would be repealed.
Okay, so Madam Chair, I guess I would have just assumed that if this bill does the early buy-in, then we would be actually repealing the language in the old GAMC bill. So then why would we need to correct this if, in fact, it's going to be repealed?
Senator Olson, there seems to be some question at the moment as to whether or not the department can implement this on June 1st, as they indicated they needed to do earlier. We have language in this bill that says if they can't implement it until July 1st, that then they would be doing retroactive Medicaid payments to cover that period of time, so that we believe that the GMC law, that portion of it, will not need to be implemented. Just in case, we wanted to make sure the correction was also included in the bill. And at this point in time, we think there is only one organization that would be affected in here that is still going to be participating in the program. So
thank you, Madam Chair. I think I understand it better now.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'd like to ask for a little further explanation and maybe for some testimony from the departments regarding the request of the Department of Corrections to start funding a portion of the sex offender work that goes on in the Department of Corrections. I know that changed some in the spreadsheet, and you and I had a brief conversation.
Yeah, it's not showing up on the spreadsheet anymore.
It shows as a savings to our general fund and it
Right.
General fund.
Right. So it's a net wash. Is there someone here from the Department of Corrections that would like to tell us why they shouldn't have to pay for the programs that they provide to their inmates?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Christ. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Facilities Division of the Department of Corrections. The, excuse me, just a brief history of the program up at Moose Lake, where we are in partnership with MSOP. The MSOP program approached us a few years back requesting such a partnership. The premise behind the program was that if the most likely offenders to be committed to the MSOP program who were still in the Department of Corrections could begin treatment while they were still in the Department of Corrections and before a decision was made by a judge to civilly commit them to the MSOP program, that those offenders might not be civilly committed, thus creating a savings to the MSOP program. The other premise behind the program was that if these offenders in corrections began treatment while they were before they went to MSOP, using the same treatment modalities as MSOP would use, that they might advance further in the program and have to spend less time in the MSOP program, again resulting in a net savings to MSOP. We entered into that program at the suggestion of MSOP. We've got 50 offenders in that program at the Moose Lake facility. We think that the program is starting to make some progress. A couple of years back, even, the clinical modalities maybe weren't quite where they should have been, but now we're told that with some new clinical leadership in that program that they are making some progress. And they're optimistic that the program will have the intended result when they came to us to enter into the partnership. The language in the bill here requires that there's a reduction to MSOP and requires that the Department of Corrections fully fund that program. At this
in
point,
the next biennium.
Madam Chair, members, that we fund $100,000 in fiscal 11 and that in the next biennium it become fully funded, correct? Madam Chair, members, we simply don't have the money in our budget to transfer from other uses to fund this program, and as we indicated in a fiscal note that was dated December of 09, we would be forced to discontinue the partnership with MSOP rather than divert the funding from other DOC programs to continue this one.
Well, Assistant Commissioner Christ, while this partnership might have been started in order to save the Minnesota Sex Offender Program money, we don't see that it has saved them any money. We see that it is saving you money because otherwise you would have to be providing sex offender treatment to these particular inmates out of your own budget. Is that not correct?
Madam Chair, members, we are not required to provide sex offender programming. We do have other sex offender programs in the Department of Corrections. There's a 200-bed program at Lionel Lakes, for instance, and that used to be the feeder program to MSOP before this partnership developed. So we would still continue to do sex offender programming in the Department of Corrections. We would discontinue the portion of our programming that is at Moose Lake.
Mr. Christ, isn't it the fiduciary responsibility of your department to provide whatever is needed to the inmates to be as successful as possible when they leave your facility?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would disagree with the characterization that it's a fiduciary responsibility. We do have a responsibility to contribute to public safety in every way that we can, consistent with the resources that are provided to us. So we make decisions about apportioning our budget, some of it to education, some of it to chemical dependency treatment, and some of it to sex offender treatment. We try to achieve a balance that is going to meet the needs of our offenders and is going to best meet overall public safety. We can't meet every need of every inmate in our facility with the resources and the funding that we have.
Mr. Chris, wouldn't you say that since you do not know who will be committed by the courts when they leave your facility, that it's been your practice to provide treatment to those sex offenders that seem as if they would be, shall we say, the most in need of treatment in order to be able to operate successfully in the community once they are released?
Madam Chair, members, we do have a system of risk assessments and actuarial assessments that indicate which offenders might be most likely to reoffend. And then we do try to get those offenders into sex offender programming.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've sat on this committee as well as Conference Committee for Public Safety, so I think I've heard a lot about this subject. And it just strikes me that in Minnesota, from a policy perspective, it seems like we can't really make up our mind how we view sex offenders. On the one hand, we are treating them as if they're able to be rehabilitated. On the other hand, which is very expensive, on the other hand, we don't rehabilitate people in terms of our track record. In fact, I don't think for all the money that we've spent, we've ever found any of these people to have been rehabilitated in recent years. And so it just seems to, so that's one comment I would make. The other comment is, you know, on the one hand, these are all state dollars. So any agency that can find savings by doing something for the state as a whole should be not so just worried about whether it's their budget that's going to save money or someone else's budget who's going to save money. There's still tax dollars that could be saved. But I've never heard that used as a rationale for transferring the cost out of a budget that would normally be the responsibility of one department and expecting a different department to pay for it. That doesn't really even make any sense to me.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the programs that the Department of Corrections operates for sex offender treatment are showing low recidivism, lower than the general population offender. So I don't have the numbers right on the tip of my tongue, but it's in single digits or the low teens for recidivism for the sex offenders that we treat in our programs compared with general population offenders where the recidivism rate is generally around 35% after 3 years.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Are you counting the people in that are released into some type of civil commitment? Because if you're counting those people, I don't know how they could reoffend. They're still locked up.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, no, we're not. We're counting those offenders who have been released and have a three-year track record.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Then it would seem to me that you're only counting the very low-level offenders because the higher-level offenders are civilly committed. And if you're comparing just low-level offenders to your general population, that's not really a valid comparison either. You'd have to compare those low-level offenders to similar-level offenders within the rest of your system.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we are able to treat in corrections about 20% of the sex offenders who come to our facilities. We, using those actuarial risk assessments I referred to earlier, we are treating the high end of the sex offenders who come to our facilities, and our study showed that those that high end of the offender spectrum that we are treating have good recidivism results, but we are not counting those offenders who do go into the MSOP program.
Assistant Commissioner Crist, this $100,000 is less than what the department pays one assistant commissioner, is it not?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct.
So, Mr. Crist, I would just respectfully disagree with you about whether you can absorb this biennium or not. And as for the next biennium, if the department needed to come and ask for an appropriation to fund the program, they could do that. But with all due respect, our budget gets criticized a lot for the growth and the total cost of our budget, and it doesn't seem fair to me that we should be having that kind of criticism when part of our budget is going to pay for services in the Department of Corrections.
Madam Chair, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to express our concerns.
You're
welcome.
Madam Chair,
can I ask?
Senator Olson.
Does the department charge back the Department of Corrections charge back the Department of Health and Human Services for treatment of people with alcohol problems or with people with mental health, gambling problems, other kinds of things that they need treatment for?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the Department of Corrections has one interagency agreement with the Department of Human Services for three chemical dependency positions. And that's the only other place where DHS is funding, in part, DOC positions.
So, Madam Chair.
Assistant Commissioner Crist, on what basis is that interagency agreement in operation?
Madam Chair, members, that interagency agreement offset three positions in the Lino Lakes sex offender program that DHS used to fund.
Well, if DHS used to fund it and they don't anymore, why are these three positions still being funded?
Madam Chair, members, DHS agreed to do that with us.
Well, then DHS must have too much money in their budget. Is there someone from DHS that would like to explain why this continues, this arrangement or this contract continues?
Just found some more money.
Well, you can bet this discussion isn't over with, folks. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Senator Rosen has a question. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Deputy Commissioner Crist, I know that the focus has been on just the $100,000 from 2011. Can you just briefly go through the budget cuts that have occurred in the past and this year, and then in the next biennium, we're looking at about a $2.4 million shift into your budget. How is this going to affect, and what is the percent? The DOC has taken a tremendous hit in their budget, and I'm just
Senator Rosen, does your question imply that DHS has not? There are administrative cuts in this budget. There have been administrative cuts in the previous budget and the previous budget also to the Department of Human Services.
Madam Chair, I know, but I'd also like to say I'd like to know what the percent cut is on a percentage basis. As this is corrections, we are dealing with a very volatile population here, and I think it's had its fair share of cuts. I do sit on public safety, and I wish I could bring those figures up at the top of my head, but I know public safety was hit very hard this year, and I know it's been hit hard in the past, and you're still trying to make up some of those cuts from the past. So I'm just concerned about not the $100,000 this year. It's the $2.4 million that's going to be shifted onto your budget next year, the next biennium, and what's that going to do?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, very briefly, we were cut in our budget, total DOC budget, about $20 million at the beginning of this biennium. And in the supplemental budget bill that was recently completed, we took another $12 million cut. The total cut, I think, to DOC was about 1.2% of the budget.
Would someone from the Department of Human Services like to come and tell us how much this biennium, including what's in this bill, would be reduced to the Department of Human Services? Well, I can guarantee it's more than 1%. I think it's at least 3%, and I think it was 3% again last year. Are there other questions? Senator Pretner Solon.
Madam Chair, I have a question on page 42 about the counseling for assisted living. And I've received multiple emails and letters from people over the past few days about this. People are concerned about it. And I'm wondering if we could have an explanation of what this is.
Senator Pretner Solon, we had a hearing on this last Wednesday. And it was laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and the savings do show up on the spreadsheet. It is a certificate that an individual would get from the Board on Aging after they have received counseling about the alternative services and what might happen to them in regard to spend down.
Madam Chair, why would it show a savings? Would people be directed to different services than they normally would have?
Not at all.
I guess.
They would be given more information, and so the fiscal note shows savings because people would voluntarily choose other alternatives, so it would be less costly.
Is the goal to not have people enter assisted living?
If they can receive less costly services elsewhere, yes, that would be the goal.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, on page 93, the moratorium of premium payments to the Minnesota Joint Underwriting Association, could we get more explanation on that? I mean, I guess I'm... we're cutting, essentially we're withholding payments up to $400,000 is the way I read the language. And are they a state agency? I guess I'm wondering if we could get some more explanation on exactly what they are.
Senator Fischbach, these are payments that come from the Department of Human Services. And the fiscal note that we got showed that there could be a period of time when the premiums wouldn't need to be paid, and it would result in a savings to the Department of Human Services.
And Madam Chair, what kind of balance do they have? I mean, what is the $400,000 significant? Or I mean, do we know what's it going to do to the stability of the account?
The indication we got is that there are surpluses in other lines of business that they handle so that there would be no worry about the solvency of the organization.
Okay. I guess I'll see if I can find more information about that because I think there may be some concern with that. And then, Madam Chair, if I might, just I'm assuming this is from the Hospital Association, this handout?
Yes.
Okay. And it reflects the current bill, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And the highlighted hospitals on there are critical access hospitals, and the reason they're highlighted is because the surcharge is deducted from their Medicare reports as an expense. And while we don't know for each hospital exactly how much that'll be, would be a significant portion of what you might see that they would be actually paying in and not receiving back out.
So, Madam Chair, that's reflected on here is what
Those are the highlighted ones.
The critical access hospitals. But what you see, Madam Chair, here is, you know, just using number one, the Bridges Medical Center. The variance between the MA surcharge and the MA payback model is 13,000-ish, it looks like. But so that's reflected there is what you're saying.
If they are not highlighted, then they're not a critical access hospital.
This one happens to be highlighted that I mentioned.
So, you know, the majority of that 13,000, they would get back as a claim against their Medicare report because they get to claim the expense on their Medicare report when they file it.
Okay. And well, Madam Chair, what I'm asking is that's not this. So this is not.
It doesn't reflect it in the 13,000 because we don't know for sure exactly with each hospital what part of their book of business is Medicare. But the Medicare critical, the critical access hospitals do get to deduct the expenditure on their Medicare report. And that's why they're highlighted, so you would know that, which ones they are.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I understand.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
This actually isn't in the bill, but I heard over the weekend that the governor has turned down the risk pool provision of the federal health plan.
I think there'll be another committee holding a hearing on that, Senator.
Okay. Will we have a chance to counteract that or to request differently?
I don't know the answer to that question. Any other questions about the bill? If not, is there a motion to adopt the spreadsheet? Senator Laurie will move adoption of the spreadsheet. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion is adopted. Then is there a motion to adopt document A9? Senator Laurie will move adoption of the A9 amendment. Are there amendments to the A9 amendment? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, the first amendment that I have today is the A12. I think it's being distributed. Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, if I may, this might be the easiest action that we have before us today. The A12 is a technical amendment. I think as it's distributed, you'll see that largely it has to deal with the title of the bill. It's a technical amendment.
Any discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor of the A12 amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
I understand Senator Lynch said it's technical, but I guess I just, it looks like it's causing something to expire that we're doing, and I just would like a little bit of an explanation of what this would do.
Mr. Giel.
Madam Chair, members, all the uncodified language in the appropriations article expires on June 30th of 2011, unless another date is specified. So this particular rider must have some impact beyond that date, and that's why we're continuing it.
Okay.
This is a Minnesota Care Ratable reduction that extends until December 31, 2013. So we want to keep that language in effect beyond June 30th of 2011.
Any other questions? Seeing none, those in favor of the amendment say aye.
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 Opposed, the amendment is adopted. Other amendments. Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. Let's see.
I have the
A6 amendment. We have the A6 amendment to be distributed. Could you distribute this at the same time? I also have a handout that will give you a visual image of what the impact of this amendment is. This is an amendment. As it's being presented or handed out, I'll begin to talk about it, if it's all right with you, Senator Berglund.
That'd be fine.
This is an amendment that would address a long-term county concern. The Association of Counties have brought it forward for us to add to this bill. It deals with concerns that there are inequities in the county level requiring spending or maintenance of effort for chemical dependency treatment costs. The change itself doesn't have any impact on the state's budget, but it does create a different way of dealing with and distributing costs for chemical dependency treatment. Currently, under the current law, there are three levels of required county match for chemical dependency treatment costs. And it creates something similar for counties to the donut hole in Medicare drug coverage. The initial level, in the first tier, the county match is applicable to all counties at 15%. That 15% amount that the counties would have to pay into is the percent of that the counties have to pay until the state's allocation is exhausted. There are several counties, 40, that never go beyond that first tier and are always at the 15% level. But once the state's allocation is exhausted, those counties that have a higher maintenance of effort pay 100% in additional of those additional chemical dependency treatment costs until such time as they've spent out their entire maintenance of effort costs, at which point they revert then back to a 15% match for any additional treatment costs.
Well, Senator Sharon, we did, as a committee, about 3 years ago, try to buy back over a six-year period this discrepancy, and we were unsuccessful in conference committee with the House. So I think most members of the committee are familiar with the quote-unquote donut hole within the formula that exists within the chemical dependency formula.
This process funds it by changing the percent and having a flat percent. It increases from 15 to 16.14, I think is the number, about 1.14 increase to the counties to pay throughout the entire for whatever their costs are for chemical dependency treatments. So because the Association of Counties in meetings with their counties have agreed, even though some counties may be paying more initially, that this is a fair way to distribute the cost of chemical dependency treatment, recognizing higher costs for some counties. So this amendment changes the match to a uniform 16.14 chemical dependency treatment costs. There's no cost to the state share, and it's supported by the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, Minnesota Association of Minnesota Counties, and the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Department of Human Services does not have a formal position on the amendment, but they do not oppose it. And you should have a handout that shows. One of the things I'd like you to think about as you look at your various counties is that that there's an instability and unpredictability in the funding requirements at the county level. Some years they'll move into the donut hole, some years not. It creates a difficulty for counties to create their budgets, and this creates an overall fair funding mechanism. And if anybody has any questions that I can't answer,
I would invite... Let's just get someone from the Association of Counties to come up here and get on the record about this.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. Patricia Coldwell from the Association of Minnesota Counties. I think Senator Sharon has given a good overview. Apparently, the spending in the chemical dependency county share has declined over the last few years, so that for about $1 million, as I understand it, it would be possible to get rid of this donut hole that Senator Berglund referenced by all of the counties paying a slightly increased county share. It moves from 15% to 16.4%, and our association has taken an official position in support of this. We think that that small share, while we never like county cost shares, but provides more stability for a relatively small amount of money and probably moves in the direction of simplicity as well.
Are there questions?
I have a question.
Senator Corn.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, was this introduced as a bill?
No, it wasn't. Senator Corey, I'm sorry.
No, it has not been introduced as a bill in the Senate.
And Madam Chair, you know, I tell you, my Monday isn't starting off very well. First of all, I think we're having to digest a whole heck of a lot of stuff here in a short period of time. And something like this, and I see there's all kinds of other amendments, a lot of these should have been introduced as a bill and gone through the Senator Marty's committee. I just don't like all this, but I guess when you're in the majority, you can do that. If I offered something like this, it probably would not pass. So I'm just not very happy about all these amendments, all of this stuff here. This was produced on Saturday, the 5-1 May Day. You know, I'm not a speed reader, so I can't go through here and know everything and how it's going to affect the people in my district.
It was emailed to you on Friday.
Sunday. Pardon me?
It was emailed to you on Friday, Senator.
All right. Well, I don't have access to my Senate email at home, so I didn't get it.
And your staff probably should have let you know that you received it.
Anyway, I'll just sit here and keep my mouth shut then.
Are there questions about the amendment? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
There is a fiscal note that's been completed that shows zero cost to the state on this. So.
Senator Sharon, I'm just trying to understand the chart you gave me. So if I'm reading on this chart where it says, let's just look at, for example, Beltrami County, which is the fourth county listed here, and it says no MOE and county share at 16.4%, and then it gives change in. I'm trying to understand just kind of what the impact it's going to be. And so if there's an overall, this is with the county share at 15%, and then on the right-hand side is if we adopted your law and
That's
made
correct.
That change. And so if the number is higher over on the right-hand side of the page, does that mean that this is going to cost that county more? Is that essentially what this would do?
Senator Berglund, Senator Olson, yes.
So if we look at the far right, the far left-hand corner, the dark column on the left side versus the far right dark column on the right side, if we have a number in parentheses, then we're getting a savings in that county. If we have a number that's not in parentheses, then it's going to be an additional cost. Is that the way it would work?
That's correct.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I'm just looking at this and just wondering what the rationale was for this to begin with. If we had something where, you know, we were expecting less of counties where they have a high level of poverty, for example, is this going to put more financial pressure on counties that tend to have, you know, I have a county, for example, with a very small tax base because we have a lot of public land and a lot of land that isn't on the tax rolls and a very low-income population. And so when I see an increase to those kinds of counties, that's going to be a property tax increase because there's no place else to essentially to go. That concerns me. And I understand your fairness argument, but I also would have to look at some of these counties that might be
more able to pay more with a larger tax base. And I don't know if that's true in how these numbers are working out. I'm just not really feeling like I've got enough time to study that or hear how that might
Senator work. Olson, I think the argument is that any county can enter the donut hole any year and not know it at the time they sent their budget and their levies. And then they're in a position of having to pay for the 100% cost of chemical dependency treatment for maybe the rest of the year and not have had it budgeted for.
Madam Chair, that's correct. And that was the rationale behind our association supporting this. Beltrami was one of the counties that did support it. I think the feeling was that a small increase would be better than the potential for a very large increase that cannot be budgeted for.
Senator Berglund.
Senator Sharon.
Ms. Caldwell, will you talk more about the conversations the associations of counties have had? As the senators look at this, they're looking at their counties, and some of them have an increased cost. So how was that dealt with through the Association of Counties, and how have those counties addressed this, as you were just indicated, recognizing that at any time they can go into the donut hole and pay 100% of their maintenance of effort costs?
Senator Sharon, are you asking what kind of feedback we've had from counties about
yes,
this?
Please.
Is that we did actually receive information on how this would work from DHS when this originally came forward, and we did survey all of our members, giving them the background information, some of the history, and the rationale behind this. And we did hear back from, I think we heard back from about 75% of the counties. Is that right? And I think that all but maybe two or three said that they thought that this was an acceptable solution. We brought that to the AMC board, and the board agreed with that position.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, I know you have a mind like a steel trap. Can you remember why this was dropped in conference committee?
Well, at that time, it was going to be a $6 million a year cost over
three or four years, I believe.
Yeah,
Madam Chair.
Yeah, it was 4 or 5 years that we were phasing in, and the House had other priorities, and so in conference we had to give it up.
I guess, Madam Chair.
We said we would come back and try and do it in another year, but we haven't had another year that we have had any money. We've always been cutting since then, so. Any other questions? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sharon, just a comment, I guess, perhaps related to Senator Coring's concern. This sounds like a really good idea, and I wish I'd had more time to be able to digest this and get back to my counties, because all three of my counties are going to be paying more. So I want to make sure with them that it's an okay thing, and they'll be able to handle it either within their reserves or however they plan to handle it, so we're not looking at increased property taxes back home. So I'm caught in between, you know, with hearing the bill for the first time and not having enough chance to check with hometown folks.
Thank you. Senator Berglund.
Senator Sharon.
Ms. Caldwell, would you like to speak to that? And can you tell us where this is at in the House? And I know that this was introduced to me fairly recently. I think Senator Coring is asking the question about why this wasn't heard as a bill.
Mm-hmm. Senator Sharon, Madam Chair, and Senator Sharon, I think that we have been talking about this idea out of conversations that arose from the Tax Committee in the House, where they are concerned. They have expressed concern and have had some joint hearings with the Health and Human Services Committees about the disparity in taxes that arises as a result of various county cost shares. And this was one that we've been in conversations with the Department of Human Services and several members of the House for the last couple of months about a way in which we could create more simplicity and basically stability without significantly increasing costs to the counties and not increasing costs to the state. And it all just basically came together relatively recently, so that's the reason. It is in the House bill that passed out of the Finance Committee and is apparently going to Ways and Means. I think it's tomorrow. I believe the language is identical to this.
Any other questions? Seeing none, then I assume people are ready to vote on the A6 amendment. Those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Well, I believe the motion does prevail. Are there other amendments? Well, I know there are some, so.
Senator Lurie.
Why doesn't Senator Lurie chair for a minute and I'll do one? This would be an amendment regarding the reduction due to the FMAP monies regarding the public health grants. I don't remember the number of the amendment. B14. Members, it should read page 109 after line 5, insert. And this is to make it clear that these public health grant reductions would only apply to the county grants and not to the ones that go to the cities and tribes, since the cities and tribes would not be a recipient of the FMAP increases.
Questions on the amendment? Okay. I don't have my copy yet. Seeing none, Senator Berglund moves the A14 amendment. All those in favor of that, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion does prevail.
Are there other amendments? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the JW17 amendment. JW17.
Senator Lynch, do you want to describe the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this has to do with case management redesign. And currently, the Department of Human Services is working on changes to comply with federal CMS waiver requirements and to implement a new comprehensive assessment that we've heard about in this division, particularly called COMPASS. And both of these efforts require a review and changes to how we deliver case management. And in working with the stakeholders throughout this session, namely the counties and legal aid, we have come up with some language that I think will help to further support those efforts and further delineate the expectations and the outcomes. And I'm pleased to say that the disability constituencies that I've been working with, the counties, DHS, legal aid, have all signed off on this and I think collectively feel that this will help ensure that we're all on the same page as we move into the interim and continue work on this redesign effort.
Is there someone from the Department of Human Services that could come forward to speak to whether this would cause the department to have a fiscal note on this language?
Madam Chair, while they're coming up, if I might, I did ask that a fiscal note be prepared. There's one was prepared, and it does reflect a zero fiscal cost, and that was from Human Services.
Could you just verify that, since we don't have copies for the members? We didn't realize there was a fiscal note on this issue that had been prepared.
I'm Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services. I can verify that there is no fiscal note on this language, or there is no cost to the department.
Thank you very much. Any discussion? Any questions? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Other amendments? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Next, I have the A11 amendment. A11.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, the A11 amendment is a subject that's reasonably familiar to the division. It has to do with the Special Medical Emergency Transportation Services. And this is an area that there has been a lot of discussion about, frankly, for the last number of years. And I'm pleased to report that the Office of the Legislative Auditor has taken this issue as one of the items that they're going to be working at on in the coming year. So I think that's great. In conversations with stakeholders, you might recall Senator Sharon had a series of work groups over the last couple of years. We had a follow-up hearing in this division a couple of months ago, and this is a net result of those continuing discussions. Two things of note here. One, on line 1.10 of the A11 amendment, this states that the level of need determinations are performed, not to be performed more than annually, and that would be a change from semi-annual. I was disappointed. I thought that this would be an avenue, a mechanism that might create some savings for us. And Madam Chair, I'm sorry to have to tell you that was prepared, and I asked that it be reviewed, and it was further reviewed, and the fiscal note came back with zero cost, but zero savings as well. I think that's an area that, with successful adoption of this might be something that we would want to follow up on at a later date to see, in fact, what the numbers really do truly reflect. The second component of the A11 amendment begins on lines 1.21 and simply follows suit to a practice that we have in many other places within, particularly, or I'm most familiar with in Health and Human Services and the Department of Health, but simply stating that contracts for level of need assessments should be independently made, and that entities that are providing level of need assessments should not be the same entity that's a provider of those services, that they should in fact be totally independent. And again, Madam Chair, the fiscal note reflects a zero cost as well as a zero savings. And while I would have liked to have seen much more work done in this area, I do think that in light of the ongoing discussions and in light of the good work that I know and trust that the legislative auditor will be doing in this area, that it is best that we
that let that be done, and I look forward to the recommendations that will come forward.
Senator Sharon?
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Lynch, for this amendment. I don't have a challenging question. I think that your comments about the fiscal note and your surprises about that are shared by me, because at a minimum, it seems to me that with the change from semi-annual to annual review, that the amount of money that the department is paying in the process of appeal will be substantially reduced. So I don't know if that had even been integrated or considered, but it strikes me that one of the issues is the consistent and constant expenditure on everybody's part to appeal these decisions, and that that'll be cut in half. So I'm very surprised that that's not accounted for. I would really like to have an explanation from somebody in the department about that. And
is there someone from the department that can come and talk about the fiscal note?
Chris Reisner from the Department of Human Services.
Welcome, Ms. Reisdorf.
Thank you. The movement from semi-annually to annually, I think that there may be a small number of reviews that will decrease from this. However, I think the vast majority of the reviews or the certifications for special transportation services are at least a year or longer as far as the length of these certifications. So I think that having the determination be annual, still based on the individual need of the person, will not decrease the number of appeals in any significant way or the number of certifications in a significant way.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Significant in these, every penny counts in our budget reconciliation. So if there was any reductions anticipated, I would think you would at least credit us with that cost savings. And then the second thing I would say, I challenge that. And I also think we should track that. Secondarily, I would like to thank Senator Lynch again. I think that even though you're not able to demonstrate cost savings, that both you and I believe are inherent in this amendment, that it is client-centered. It is, even though there is no cost to the state, we're doing something that really creates a significant change for consumers of this system, and that has a value in and of itself. So thank you for this amendment.
Are there other questions about the amendment? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Lynch, there has been talk about the consumers on this, and I'm talking about Section 32. How is this? Is this going to affect portions of deep rural or greater Minnesota with these contracting and the conflict of interest, where perhaps there is not a large, you know what I'm trying to say?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, this is really good when I'm reading your mind.
Yes, sad.
I don't know that this will either add to that stress nor deter that stress. But rather, I think that from a business standpoint, there's an inherent conflict when the same entity, the same provider, is providing a level of need assessment determining whether or not individuals are eligible for service or not, and it's the same entity that's providing the service. There's an that's a difficult and questionable arrangement to be in. And so that's really at the heart of this. The issue of access in greater Minnesota is much larger than this amendment. And I hope in part that is one of the issues that will be come forward with some further recommendations in the work that the legislative auditor is doing.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And without saying too much about it, I would just also like to thank both Senators Lynch and Senator Sharon for working on the issue. And I would only echo, though, that in terms of conflict of interest, well, it's good to identify them where they exist and to move forward. Our whole system is so We have so many conflicts of interest built into our healthcare system that I believe are partly responsible for why we have increased costs, that wherever we can identify them and try to eliminate them, that's a good thing to do from a consumer cost-saving standpoint. When we have a department, though, and this is an issue that's come up over and over the years, giving us fiscal notes on things that impact their budget going up and down, you know, there's a conflict of interest there, too. And so I would just echo for you the concern that if there are savings, we should see them reflected. Or we should be looking for another way to analyze fiscal notes by someone independent, done by an independent means that doesn't, that isn't working within a department whose budget is going to be affected.
Other questions on the amendment? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, Senator Olson beat me to the punch. I was going to go to the same point. Senator Lynch, I think this is a great beginning on the philosophy of setting a precedent here between separating out contracts, the people who do the contracts and do the assessments, and, you know, having an opportunity to push money into their own pockets. So this is great. I hope we can use this as a precedent, because it makes me wonder about conversations we've just recently had. Would this then also apply to, for example, health plans who happen to own their hospital, and they have certainly a financial interest in the provision of medical services? So I would agree with Senator Olson. The more often we can start separating out people who have a financial interest in the way they run the business, I think it's a good strategy. I hope we get your support in future bills, Senator Lynch.
Any other discussion of the amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So, Senator Lynch, there has been abuses in the situation that have been apparent. With somebody who was doing the contract and also providing the services, there has been abuses of that system, of that setup.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rosen, I think I would best characterize it by saying that for a number of years, a number of people on this division and Senator Marty's committee as well have been working with all of the stakeholders, metro, non-metro, within the department, outside of the department, patients and clients. And there's been enough angst along the way and over the years that has warranted the Office of the Legislative Auditor to take a large look at the entire delivery system. And so I would just like to suggest that we defer from making any definitive statements until the work of that auditors is done. And I think the recommendations that will come forward, as they typically are from the Legislative Auditor's Office, will provide some good insight and direction to the division.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
And Senator Lynch, I guess I'm perhaps a little more comfortable waiting till the OLA's recommendations come out instead of, unless this came, if this suggestion came from a very reliable source or from the industry itself, I'm not sure why we are doing this until we figure out the direction that we should be going.
Senator Sharon.
Well, there has been a great deal of information presented that relates to the number of appeals that have had to occur and that they've been successful and overturned those appeals. When a person's been what I call downcoded from an STS level of service to an ATS level of service, we now have a system where the same persons that do the level of need assessment to determine if they are STS or ATS eligible also, once that assessment is completed and they're paid for that, get another set of reimbursement dollars for arranging the ATS rides in a certain part of the state. The contract with the provider of these assessment services and these arrangement services, that's in the past. Chris, we eliminated that last session. We're looking at changes in trends and patterns from STS to ATS services and looking at what might be creating the motivation for that. And in order to have good policy that separates out any economic incentive that would come to changing a coding based on the fact that you can get reimbursed a second time, be eliminated from the process. There's no accusation that anybody is placing, that somebody is acting inappropriately. But we are securing with this legislation the proper arm's length transactions between things that have the potential for conflict.
Any other discussion? If not, then those in favor of the A11 amendment indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Are there any other amendments? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the A3 amendment.
Lynch, you want to describe the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A3 amendment is continuing the discussion on the dental therapy legislation that was passed in 2009. I'm really pleased to acknowledge and support there are 9 students at the University of Minnesota currently enrolled in this program, and there are 7 students at Metropolitan State enrolled in this program. And those students are virtually halfway through their training to become the first dental therapist in this country to operate outside of the tribal lands in the state of Alaska. So I think that's really exciting. As with any new program and new discipline, they're continuing to work on successful implementation of this program. The language in this amendment exempts the 2 existing Minnesota dental therapy education programs from the requirements that the Board of Dentistry approve their programs, and uses the money that would have otherwise been used for this to grants to both of those institutions. So that would be a grant to the University of Minnesota and a grant to Minnesota State Colleges and Universities to help them further assist in the development of their dental therapy programs. And I think in hindsight, in the 2009 legislation, we gave the Board of Dentistry the task of approving the educational programs for the dental therapy programs. And that was rather unusual. It was quite unusual in that for most other disciplines, that would not be the case. For most other disciplines, the educational programs are put together and approved by those institutions. I can tell you that both the University of Minnesota and our Minnesota State Colleges and Universities are extremely motivated to put together good, solid, strong programs in this area. And I can only imagine, based on the number of calls that my office has gotten on this legislation, I know that each of our institutions, likewise, are getting calls and inquiries from across the state, or I'm sorry, across the country, from other institutions that are watching and monitoring and want to learn from the work that we're completing here. The Board of Dentistry was asked to come in. They came to Senator Marty's committee on March 17th of this year. It was an opportunity to get kind of an update from the Board of Dentistry, from MNSCU, from the university, on implementation of this program. At that time, they reported to us that one of the challenges, a great challenge for them, frankly, was in the approval of the educational programs. In part, because this is not the normal function of the board, and they had put together an RFP to solicit an outside consultant to assist them in this effort. They did that. The RFP was put out, and there were no responses to the RFP. So in discussions with the institutions and in meeting these students, the students are so excited to be a part of this program. It's been really fun to watch them grow and develop. I think it's also worth noting that there are students that are entertaining the notion of entering into these new programs, and they're a little cautious about entering into the program because the educational program hasn't yet been approved, and there's already a class of students that's nearly halfway through. So I think that the amendment will provide some additional, a little bit small, limited funds to both institutions. I think it will go a long ways in helping the students that are currently in the program to gain some satisfaction in knowing that so long as they pass their competencies and put in their clinical hours and all of the things that are required of them, that this won't be a hindrance for them to be able to practice. Madam Chair, just one final note. There's no resulting fiscal note from this change.
But, Senator Lynch, we don't have a fiscal note, so I'm going to ask that we discuss this, but that we wait till we get a fiscal note before it would be added to the bill, because while you've appropriated money here, we need to make sure that this amount of money is actually available to be appropriated. All right, discussion.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I would say I would appreciate that, and it might help expedite the fiscal note because we have we've been asking for that fiscal note, so I appreciate the help.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Lynch, as you know, over the last couple of years, and I know you've spent a lot of time on this issue, this has been a very hotly debated topic with strong feelings on both sides. And last year, the two sides finally came together with something that I think, you know, the message was clear to the dentists that the legislature was interested, or at least the majority of people in the legislature were interested in doing something like this. But it was totally predicated on the fact that the Board of Dentistry was going to have the ability to have some input into the education and approval over the program. And so now I guess I'm sort of really surprised that we'd get an amendment offered like this on what's essentially a really hotly debated policy issue a year later without an opportunity for the dentist to weigh in as they would if we had a bill. And basically just taking away the part that was the compromise that was reached last year. I just don't think that that would be fair at all to the dentists. And and frankly, my personal concern is this. I do understand that you're concerned about access issues, and we have certainly had a lot of access issues in some parts of the state and in some demographic areas where people can't afford to pay for their dental care. But on the one hand, we need to balance those access issues with making sure that people are still getting access to care that's the same quality as the care anyone else would get. And so having the dentist as professionals involved in how those standards are going to be developed, I think, is entirely appropriate. And I just really, so I can't support your bill both from a policy perspective, but mostly from a process perspective, that it's being introduced here without notice to the dentists or an opportunity to hear from them.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson. I think I can tell you in all honesty that the communication between the Board of Dentistry and my office has been on a very continued cycle for several years now. And in part, when the legislation was passed in 2009, although it didn't say it in statute, Senator Marty, Senator Pappas, Senator Berglund, the three main chairs involved, was very much the intent that we would afford the entities an opportunity to come back and report to us on the implementation and how this was going. I think one of the things that we all share is we want successful implementation of this new proposal. When the hearing was held in March, the Board of Dentistry indicated that they did not have the expertise to be able to meet this requirement. They didn't have the expertise to be able to approve educational programs. In light of that, they indicated that they had put together an RFP soliciting outside assistance for that effort. No assistance was forthcoming. And so coupling that with the concerns from the students in the program and from the institutions, coupled with the fact that in most of the other healthcare fields, this is not the way that educational programs are approved, that's what you see in the amendment is a reflection of all of those continued and very much ongoing conversations. And let me stress that we are talking today about only the approval of the educational program. That is the programs that are being put forward by the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Nothing in this amendment does anything in the area of accreditation, which is an entirely different matter, which falls under the Board of Dentistry. And it's my understanding that the board is continuing to work with the Commission on Dental Accreditation, CODA. CODA has no method of accrediting dental therapy programs because we're the first in the country. And so I want to reiterate that nothing in this bill diminishes or will detract or dilute accreditation of these programs in Minnesota.
Senator Prettner-Sullen.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, I was very instrumental also in negotiating that bill last year. And I would say that if we hadn't negotiated, there probably wouldn't have been a bill. And I believe that you couldn't be further from the truth in your statement that the board doesn't have a role to play in the education of the members that it licenses. We just passed a bill 2 or 3 years ago from the social workers in which they dictated the educational requirements that would have to be included at the university levels in order to license the members under the Board of Social Work. I certainly know that the Board of Psychology dictates to me what my educational requirements are in order to secure my license. And the fact that they didn't have the expertise is because it's totally novel program. It's not because they aren't experts in the field. It's because it means they have to create and set up the requirements that will, as Senator Olson says, allow not only access but also safety for the person that's receiving the services of the dental therapist. So I can't support your bill either.
Is it a bill or is it an amendment?
An amendment.
It's an amendment, and we don't have a fiscal note, so.
Can I ask a question?
I'm not comfortable with this being added today. Yes, Senator Fleming.
Was this, Madam Chair and Senator Lynch, was this offered as a, I'm on the higher, you're on the Higher Education Committee too. Was this offered as a bill?
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, no. It's largely an offshoot of the hearing that Senator Marty held on March 17th, which was an opportunity for the stakeholders to come back and talk with us about the implementation and any concerns or questions that they had regarding implementation.
Other discussion? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Lynch, for the students that are already going through the program, if this bill or this amendment is not put on, what's the effect for them?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I can just anecdotally tell you what's been shared with me from the students and from the institutions. And I think it's twofold. I think for the students, and there are 16 of them, for those 16 students, I think this would go a long way in giving them the assurance and confidence that if they go through their programs and if they achieve their clinical hours and if they pass their test and if they enter into an agreement with a collaborating dentist and put together that collaborative management agreement, that they'll be out serving those most in need. Without this, it creates anxiety for those students and for the institutions and for our greater access issue. I can certainly understand, and if you either had a student or you were a student who was contemplating going into this program in Minnesota, you might think twice about whether or not you want to enter into a program that hasn't been yet approved. And so I think we're trying to smooth that hurdle just a bit, knowing that both of these institutions are accredited and that this program will be in line for accreditation by COTA, at which time it is practical.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, because an institution is accredited doesn't mean that its new programs will be accredited. They still have to go through a process. And accreditation usually extends back 5 years and covers people who have gone through the program up to 5 years. This is the same for any program that anybody goes through that's new. And I don't think that we want to bypass that system.
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner-Solon, again, we're not bypassing the accreditation process at all. In fact, we're not diluting the accreditation process at all. In the statute, in the legislation that we passed, there's a provision that talks about accreditation, and there's a separate provision that talks about the educational programs. And what we're trying to address today is just the educational programs. I acknowledge that we may have a difference of opinion on this, but I think we need to be clear that we're talking about the program approval at the institutional level.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, it's more than a difference of opinion. It's a difference of facts. And the education does go into whether an institute or whether a program gets accredited or not. And so I think we need to be very, very careful that the educational components are enough to support the accreditation of the program.
Senator Sharon.
I would just like to speak to this same issue because I think I'm organizing in my mind a little bit different than Senator Prettner-Solon. So with regard to what's being said,
I also come from a profession that has an accreditation process. And it is through the accreditation process that the institutions know clearly, in order to get accredited, which is of high value, what has to be incorporated in the educational program. But the design of the curriculum at Minnesota State University School of Nursing is not designed by the Nurses Association. It is certainly the national organizations and accrediting bodies that will decide whether or not that particular program gets accredited. And it certainly influences the decision-making about the development of that program. But the input for the design of the curriculum is not held in the hands of a national organization. And this amendment is not about that accreditation. It's about allowing the institutions to design their curriculum, which is what occurs in our profession.
Senator Erickson-Robes, you haven't had anything to say yet. And then I'd just like to remind Senator Lynch that I don't have a fiscal note on this. So I don't know if this money is even available to be spent.
Madam Chair, thank you much. And Senator Lynch, I guess that was to my point. This is a policy bill. I think it needs some broader discussion. Since the fiscal note is not here for this body to discuss in terms of the budget, I wonder if... Senator Lynch, a more appropriate place to have this discussion might be in Senator Marty's committee. We had that hearing, and I do know that he's putting together another couple of meetings, mostly related to federal health care reform. Perhaps he'd be willing to hear this in policy, and then we could fully discuss it there and advance the bill here for the fiscal.
Well, of course, the budget bill, I would hope, members, is going to be voted on today. So if this is going to catch up to the budget bill at some point, it would be down the road, not here. Because I can't wait longer. Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I'm cognizant of the fact that there's no fiscal note and would not expect that the division would make any movement on an amendment that didn't have a fiscal note. So we've not formally moved anything on this amendment. I think the discussion has been good, and I'm happy to move on.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Well,
so the amendment's been withdrawn. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
I don't know if it's a higher motion, if a motion's been withdrawn, to lay something on the table to at least have taken some action on it, but frankly, if this is going to be presented on the floor as an amendment without any action on this, then I think it's important to know what the vote on the issue itself would be, because, again, I'm very concerned that we had an agreement last year between the dentists and the people who worked.
Well, Senator, there's no motion before us, so there's no amendment or anything that can be done with it.
Well, Madam Chair, then I guess I can move the bill, even though I'm planning to vote against it.
The only motion that would be in order is to move...
Or the amendment, I should say, move the amendment.
Well, Senator Olson, I will say the same thing to you. I think it's inappropriate for this to be offered and for us to be voting on it without a fiscal note. I don't usually rule things out of order, but I mean, if this money is available, it's available. If it isn't, it isn't. And if it isn't available, we can't be appropriating it, because it will then affect, you know, the money has to come out of the bill then.
Well, Madam Chair, I understand that without a fiscal note, I understand what you're saying, but I am concerned that, again, if the bill is going to come back down the road and would normally have had a vote by this committee in terms of how it would be presented on the floor as far as the opinion of this committee, that...
Well, Senator Olson, I wish I could limit amendments that might be offered to this bill after it leaves this committee, but I don't get to do that either. So that's the way it is, I guess. Did you have something to...
Madam Chair, if, and
testifying
members...
Testifying about a withdrawn amendment, or are you here to tell us you have a fiscal note?
I can clarify some things with regard to the... I do not have a fiscal note. I just became aware of this today.
Then I just, you know, we don't have anything in front of us.
All I can tell you is that the money that is addressed within this bill, Madam Chair, it was not allocated to the board in the last legislative session. The dollar amount is not accurate. So,
well, then get us a fiscal note, would you?
I'd be happy to do that.
Good.
Thank you for asking. Okay.
Are there any other amendments? Any other amendments? Any other amendments? Seeing no other amendments, is there a motion that Senate File 2337, as amended, be recommended to pass?
I move. So moved, Chair.
Senator Lynch will make that motion. Any further discussion? Any further discussion? Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion is adopted. We do have another bill.
Madam
Chair.
Let
me give just a couple minutes for those who want to clear the room. But the members should stay because we do have another bill on our agenda. Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, could you just give me some idea? Now, this will be in this, the Health and Human Bill will be in finance tomorrow and then on the floor the following day, or does it have, it doesn't have to go anywhere else, right?
It doesn't go anywhere else, Senator Fischbach. All I know is that it's scheduled pending the action we just took here for 2:30 tomorrow and the Finance Committee. When it will be heard on the floor, I don't know myself yet.
Is it just, is it the intent this to have it done by the end of this week?
Yes, I would hope so.
What's going on? That's your text.
No, I'd rather have that come from Colin, I think. Or somebody, yeah. Because that's going to get in the
this should have been.
So,
higher ed.
The next bill we have on our agenda is a bill that we heard earlier. Senate File 3175, and there have been some work done to further amend it, hopefully to affect the fiscal note. So, Senator Anderson.
Whatever. I would just say that remember how you always treat people the way you want to be treated, because if someday you wind up in the minority, the majority does to you, how would you feel? You know, and I will tell you that when the next election happens, I don't know if I'm going to be back here, you will not have 46 members, somewhere less. And you know, I can remember when I was there, my first time here.
This is before this.
You guys had 32. You couldn't override the old governor.
I was told she was moving the dates.
Then you had to. Now you don't have to, and you don't. And you know, it just,
yeah.
Just kind of, it's frustrating.
Where does it do that?
I think that
this one or that?
I wanted to move that bill.
She's got another one, so just set this one aside.
Okay. She wants to do it.
No, the other one amends this.
Yep, that's good.
Who cares?
Yes, very good. Good enough.
I need that one.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. I very much appreciate that you've had a very busy morning and that you're willing to give us a little time to try to conclude action on Senate File 3175. Members, you'll remember we came to you when was it, 2 weeks ago, to talk about ice arenas? I forget when it was, but we have been doing, we keep working on this issue, thank you, and we've made really great progress just today on changing some elements in the bill to bring down the fiscal note. We've worked closely with the health department. We've been working with the ice arena managers. I worked today with Ramsey County, and I think we've alleviated just about all concerns that are out there with our amendment that I'd like to offer. And we do have the A12 amendment as the latest version, but I'd like to put the bill in the right shape.
Is the A12 amendment an amendment to the bill or to the A10 amendment?
It's an amendment to the A10 amendment.
So then somebody needs to move the A10 amendment because we never adopted it last time. Senator Erickson Ropes will move the A10 amendment. And then we have an A12 amendment. Do you want to explain the amendment, A12 amendment to the A10 amendment, Senator
Mary,
Anderson?
Mary, I need the A10 amendment. Right here. Oh, never mind. Thank you. I'm good. I have the 12. Thanks.
Yeah.
I'm good.
So, Madam Chair, what would you like me to explain?
Well, I think
first,
we talked about the A10 amendment, but we didn't adopt it. So now at least we have a motion that it's on the table. The next thing would be to amend the A12 amendment to the A10 amendment. I just wanted to give you a chance to explain the amendment before we consider that motion.
Could you pass that out, please?
Great. I will do that, Madam Chair. And just to refresh your memory, what we had done is, well, this is, bill has gone a very, very, very long ways from where we started.
Put it on hold.
What I think the easiest way to explain this is to look at the A10 amendment and then tell you how it's changing with the A12.
Yes.
Because we're changing some dates.
Go ahead.
And some other small things. So if you look at the A10 amendment, first we have a requirement for arenas to have someone trained either on site or on call who has knowledge about the air quality standards that are in law and rule and the maintenance of the equipment to maintain those, to meet those standards. We are changing that date from 2011 to 2012. And this is part of, we're changing a number of dates so that there really is no fiscal impact in 2011. On the health department, and we've pushed out as much of it as we can to 2012, and we've reduced it significantly. So the training requirement would not apply till 2012, and that's part of the A12 amendment, line 1.3. We also change some language on 1.14, and instead of saying you have to be trained on the symptoms of or the signs of acute and chronic exposure to elevated levels of carbon monoxide and nitrogen dioxide, you would have to be trained in exposures because there were some problems with having understanding of chronic symptoms. So that is 1.4 of the amendment. Then what we have done in this, in the next subdivision, subdivision 2, the way we have this set up is that we had the new, with the new language, by next March, March of 2011, all ice arenas would need to have their resurfacers, or known as Zambonis, popularly known as Zambonis, would have to have catalytic converters on them. We take ice edgers out of that requirement because there are catalytic converters available, but they're not as commonly available for ice edgers. And so we are saying for ice resurfacers, which is the Zamboni-like equipment, you have to have a catalytic converter installed by next March. So that's really the only requirement that occurs in 2011. However, you'll look at the amendment and you can see that if you can't find a catalytic converter that you can add on to your old Zamboni, then that you're exempt from that, and you just have to make sure that when you replace your Zamboni or your resurfacer, that it is either, and any new one that you would buy would be equipped with a catalytic converter. They've been sold only with catalytic converters for about 20 years. So Only the very oldest machines do not have these, so this will affect only a very small universe of ice arenas around the state. Those that have very old resurfacers will have to install, add on a catalytic converter by next year if they can find one to purchase. And if they can't, then when they replace that resurfacer, it would have to be either one with a catalytic converter or an electric one, which all of them, that any replacement one would include that. And then for the ice edging equipment, we're putting that replacement requirement in. Instead of requiring them to upgrade them by next March, we're saying that when they replace the edger, it would have to be equipped with a catalytic converter, which is an option available whenever you purchase a new one. So the new ones, the new models have these, but a lot of the old models don't. So we want to be realistic and say when you replace it, you have to include the option of a catalytic converter, which reduces emissions by at least 70%, or go electric. So those are the options when you replace. We don't have a deadline. And so that's in the amendment, that paragraph that you'll see on the amendment lines 1.6 to 1.12. And then we also, if you look at paragraph B of subdivision 2, 1.22 of the A10 amendment, you'll see that we also require that you don't use equipment 2 hours before skaters are on the ice. We limit that to non-Zamboni equipment. So Zamboni equipment obviously has to be used before every game, and so they're not covered by this, but ice edgers would be, and those are not used on a before each game. Those are used periodically. So that was suggested by the Ramsey County Parks, which is the largest arena manager in the state. And so that requirement would apply to construction that's being done in an arena or to ice edgers, that they couldn't be used less than 2 hours before skaters take on the ice. And then you'll see by 2014 is the requirement that's already in A10. And that's 4 years out. And that says that by 2014, if you're not in compliance with air quality standards, only then would you have to either upgrade to electric equipment or purchase carbon monoxide and nitrogen dioxide monitoring equipment. So it's really a very, very softened requirement that only applies to those out of compliance 4 years from now. And so I think, again, that would only affect a very, very small universe of arenas, and most would not be affected at all. Should I finish going through the amendment? I'm almost done, and then I'd be happy to take questions. We removed the language on 1.26 of the A10 amendment that talks about significantly and repeatedly exceeding air quality standards. We just strike significantly and repeatedly. We also strike the date on 1.28 of the A10, which is the deadline for rulemaking. And we also strike that same language on 2.8. So essentially we're telling the health department, go back, when we're done with this legislation, go back and finish your rulemaking, which you already started. We're not going to put a deadline on that because, again, they're trying to catch up. And they have very limited staffing, and so we agreed to take that deadline out, and they will do their very best to get those rules done. I'm very confident of that, but we didn't want to put a deadline in there that might not be able to be met. The only other changes we have if you look at the A10 amendment, are the report that we're having the health department do on the bottom of page 2. We also extend that out one more year, so they wouldn't have to report back to us till 2011 about how many rinks are in compliance, how many are in violation, how many they've inspected. Basically information that they're already required to have anyway. But we wanted to have a baseline of information. Once the rulemaking is done, then we will have that baseline of information going forward. So we've reduced that to 1 year's data at the health department's request as well, instead of the past 3 years of data. So that's at the bottom of page 2, and you'll see that on the A12 amendment. So basically the health department, the only thing they'd have to do for the remainder of this year and for 2011 is to continue their rulemaking. And the only thing the arenas would have to do in the next year is by next year by 2011, they would have to, if they have a very old Zamboni without a catalytic converter, they'd have to install a new one if it's available. And then the other requirements are phased in on a very gradual timeline. With this amendment, I know Ramsey County Parks and Rec, as I mentioned, they run the largest arena system in the state, and with the changes that we have here, they are in support of the bill, and they can testify. They are willing to testify if you'd like to take the time. I've also talked with the head of the MIAMA, the Ice Arena Managers Association, Michael Shagaby. I don't know if he's here. He was coming over. The House hearing is in a short time as well, and so I'm not sure if he's going to be here, but he is very comfortable with where we're going, and the House has a slightly different approach, but we can certainly reconcile that because they are in support of where we're both going and are not objecting to the bill, to either one of the bills in the form that they're in.
Senator Anderson, I was mistaken. The bill was laid on the table by motion, so Senator Erickson Ropes withdraws her motion to adopt the A-10 amendment, and if we want to consider these things, we would need a motion to remove the bill from the table. Senator Erickson Ropes would move that the bill, Senate File 3175, be removed from the table. Senator Pretner Solon, normally that's not really debatable, but
Madam Chair, I'm inclined to vote against it unless I can ask some questions about it first. I understand the rules, but
go ahead.
Senator Anderson, I've received some concerns from the DEC, and we're an old facility. We've been there since 1964, or 66, I think it was, and we're building a new arena this year. We've never had a violation, ever. Have we had a violation, and they've been monitoring air quality. But they do have some concerns about some provisions in your bill, and we're especially having some concerns. I mean, we will have state-of-the-art facility as we're moving forward, and so we don't anticipate we'll have a violation either. However, the provision on page 1.22 to 1.25, the DEC often has between periods of games, they need to get either an automobile or an ATV out on the ice to drive around as part of a promotion. And these vehicles are provided by UMD sponsors, and UMD finds that they get it's a big source of revenue for them. And it appears that this would impact their ability to do that, that they would no longer be able to do that.
Madam Chair,
Anderson.
Senator Pretner Solon, they haven't talked to me about that concern, and I was under the impression that the large commercial facilities like the DEC and XL would not be covered by these standards, but I guess we need some clarification on that. But that's a very limited issue, which I'm sure we could accommodate to. I mean, I'm sure willing to accommodate it, and I agree with you. When they retrofit, they're going to meet and far exceed any of the requirements in this bill. So that's something I'd be happy to put in an exemption if we need to for that. I don't have a problem with that.
And then, Madam Chair.
Senator Pretner Solon.
The other objection is to the placard that has to be put out there that is really not inviting to guests, especially when we have large exhibits in our area, to say that you may be encountering chronic levels of carbon monoxide and nitrogen dioxide in the arena, and it certainly will scare people away when we've never had a violation. We've never exhibited any of that in our facility.
I'm trying to, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Trying to remember if we still have that. Oh, here we go. Placement of it.
11.
Maybe present. Okay. I'm really glad that that's the biggest objection to the bill now. That's really good news. I think we're making huge progress. And you know, this bill was brought to me by hockey parents who are concerned about their children and also want to know about what's going on in their arenas, because people don't really know what, even though arenas already test for air quality. And so that's why they had asked that we have information to the public so that they can try to look for, you know, they can go to the manager and ask them for their testing results already. They could do that now. But this was just an effort to try to raise awareness because a lot of parents, it never occurred to me as a hockey mom that my son, and it should have, but it just, I never thought about it, that he could be exposed to carbon monoxide in an ice arena. So that was why we put it in here. I guess you make a good point. You don't want to set a negative tone, especially if they're meeting air quality standards. So I'm not sure what to suggest on that.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you can imagine, hockey up in our neck of the woods is also a big concern, and parents on the one hand are concerned about safety, but they're also concerned. A lot of times our arenas are paid for by volunteer dollars, and costs are a big issue. And I really appreciate all the work you've done with working on both sides to try to make this a workable bill. I just have a couple of observations. By taking out the language that has to do with the repeated nature of things. I can't remember exactly.
That's 1.26
right.
On A10.
Significantly and repeatedly. Mm-hmm. And it kind of goes to Senator Prettner-Solon's point. There may be reasons why someone has an isolated air quality spike, whether it's construction, whether it's driving a vehicle out on the ice, whatever that reason may be. And in life, there are lots of, and there are things that people do to minimize exposure to that. If it's construction, for example, you may not have kids there skating, as you said, or, you know, you may be doing other things, but there's no way that you could always be in conformity. Or maybe you have a different piece of equipment that malfunctions that has to be replaced. And so it seemed to me that when that language was in there, it allowed for kind of common sense to be able to be implied, where if you really have an ongoing problem, you're going to take care of it. But by removing that language and then saying that the fix is going to be you have to buy these other things, and maybe they didn't even cause the problem. You know, maybe it's not your ice resurfacing equipment that caused the carbon dioxide to spike, so why are you having to replace that when it might be something else entirely that caused the air quality problem? So I liked it better with that language in there, or else I would have to say that there should be something tying to that the air quality problem was caused by that piece of equipment that you're having to replace. Otherwise, there's, to me, a nexus there that's missing. And then the only other thing I was going to say is about the notices. Perhaps you could have a more neutral-sounding notice that just says something like, you know, information about air quality standards is available, is kept by law and can be obtained from the manager or something like that, so it doesn't imply something negative.
Madam Chair, on the placard, I think that's a really good suggestion for a compromise that maybe would make everyone. I see one hockey mom nodding at me. I think that's a good idea. On the issue of significantly and repeatedly, that's exactly why I put those words in there, because you might have a spike at one time and, you know, it doesn't reflect a pattern or a practice. The health department had concerns about this language because they said, well, we'll have to figure out what that means in our rulemaking. And so they wanted to be able to establish under what conditions you would be in violation that triggered these requirements. And so I think your concerns are appropriate, but I think they will be addressed in the rulemaking. And so, and we can, if there's a way we can state that, I'd be fine with saying the health department in their rulemaking needs to figure out what air quality violations would trigger these requirements or what level of violations. Or they just don't want us to use language that they're not sure what it means because they were concerned that that would sort of make them put them in a box when they try to set standards. So this has been an effort to, I should say that I think the fiscal note, okay, you have the old fiscal note in front of you. I think the new one's coming around. And what we've been told by the health department today is that with the changes in this amendment, the fiscal note would be zero for 2011, and then in 2012 it would be less than what we see in 2011 now. So it would be, you know, it's right now they show 37,000 in 10 and 126 in 11, and these would be shifted out a year, and they would be lower because of the changes. I guess what I would ask, maybe, Madam Chair, I know we can't spend all day on this, so maybe you and I had talked about the possibility, if this division is willing to move the bill forward, if I could offer it as an amendment onto the omnibus bill in the Finance Committee, I could put in the language that makes it clear that those deck events would be exempted, and that we could put in language that would be clear that the Health Department would set standards for when these 2014 requirements would take effect and under what circumstances, because I think you're, I'm not disagreeing with you, it's just a matter of what words we put in here that will not cause them problems, but will also get to the issue that you're raising, because I think it's legitimate. Mm-hmm. If members are comfortable with that, I could prepare an amendment like that for tomorrow and share it with both of you in advance to see if you were comfortable with it.
Senator Pretner Solon and then Senator Rosen.
And Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, the one last thing is about making the placard a positive statement rather than a negative statement.
A positive statement about air quality?
About the air quality.
This arena complies with Minnesota air quality standards for carbon monoxide and nitrogen dioxide.
Or that it's constantly, that it is being monitored for anyways, not instead of.
Well, it's not being constantly monitored under current law or even under this bill.
But that monitoring does occur. Mm-hmm. To ensure the safety of the people that are in the facility.
Well, again, we could ask the Health Department to come up with the correct language there. I think if members are comfortable with that. My staff pointed out we didn't delete significantly and repeatedly, even though that was my intention because the Health Department had asked me to take those words out. But we can work on tweaking that. I'm fine with, you know, just saying there needs to be something posted that explains, that references air quality, and, you know, so that the public has access to information. That's really the intention.
I think Ms. Kavanagh has a comment to make at this point in time.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, significantly and repeatedly, that's taken out in the amendment on line 14.
Oh, thank you. Of course. There it is.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Anderson, I appreciate your work on this. I'm not really quite sure. It looks like you've done a tremendous amount of work on this. However, I have some significant problems with this, too, and I'm hoping that you'll – I'm not comfortable moving it out, voting for this, because there are areas in this bill that are going to significantly impact – the arenas out in Greater Minnesota, such as there, obviously somebody who's in charge of the equipment is going to have to go and get some significant training from MDH as far as they're learning the rules of air quality and recognizing the signs of exposure. So that's one of my concerns is that going to be paid for? I mean, it's hard to even define some people that do the maintenance on these arenas that are multi-use arenas, and they're not just specifically used for ice and hockey during the winter. And also, on page 3, line 7, the number of indoor ice arenas that fail to submit weekly air quality measurements as required by law, so MDH is going to have to, or the person in charge of the arena is going to have to submit these weekly requirements? That's,
Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson.
This is based on current law and current rules. I thought it was quarterly. I'm not sure why it's – maybe I'm
– This is new language, Madam Chair.
There's – what's new language?
Page 3, line 7.
Yeah, the number of indoor ice arenas that failed to submit weekly air quality measurements as required by rule. Now, current rule requires them, I believe, to submit quarterly.
submit, but they...
But test weekly.
Yes.
So right now, under current law, every arena has to go out with a tube on the ice once a week and test the air quality. And then they're supposed to submit that data on a quarterly basis to the Department of Health. So that's current law, and that's what they all should already have been doing for several decades. So since the 70s, I believe. So that shouldn't be onerous.
So, Madam Chair.
But this, we just want to know which arenas are not submitting that data.
I see.
So okay. that's where the efforts could be, you know, concentrated. That's where the health department could focus their efforts on trying to get those arenas up to par. Okay.
Oh, well, Madam Chair, and I understand your intent here, Senator Anderson. Very similar, but not to the degree that the swimming pool legislation had the effect on Greater Minnesota swimming pools, and it has closed down many of those pools out there. And I voted for that legislation. I think it was a good piece of legislation, but we were unaware of the effect that would have on swimming pools out, especially out in Greater Minnesota, where many of those communities, that's all they have, is a swimming pool, and perhaps, you know, an ice arena. We can only hope so. So I just think this needs to be vetted through a little bit more. It needs to have, I understand Ramsey County is here, but I haven't heard any testimony or any information coming from the area that I serve or Greater Minnesota where how it's going to affect those arenas, and that's what I would like to know.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson, then I'd just like to remind members that we're being very generous with the rules here, and the motion is to take the bill off the table. And we could vote on that pretty soon, I think.
Madam Chair.
Anderson.
I just want to be, I wanted to ask, and you probably don't want to take testimony right now then.
Well, I don't think testimony on a motion to take a bill off the table is in order. If the motion passes, then we can take testimony.
Madam Chair, Mr. Mack, the reason I asked him to come forward from Ramsey County is that I wanted to address the issue of training because, again, a lot of arenas already do train their operators. And so some of this already exists. And so I don't think we're adding as I said, really, there's very limited new requirements that would take effect unless an arena is in violation of air quality standards. So.
Okay, we have the motion before us. Those in favor of removing Senate File 3175 from the table indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Madam Chair,
now let's see if we can get enough votes to pass.
could I ask Mr. Mack to very briefly just talk about what's available for training for operators?
Madam Chair, my name is Greg Mack. I'm a director of Parks and Recreation for Ramsey County, and Ramsey County is somewhat unique. We are the largest agency operating ice arenas probably in the country. We have 11 indoor ice arenas. And have been doing this since 1962. As has been testified by others and members of the committee, we've had no incidents of problems in our arenas since our inception. However, we have continued to work with the Department of Health with all of the standards that have been in place today, the ones in 1977 where we do weekly monitoring. But in terms of the testing side and the training, we have there is the Minnesota Ice Arena Association that was referenced by Senator Anderson that does meet a couple times a year, and they focus on training, providing high-quality services. And the Minnesota Department of Health has worked with the Minnesota Ice Arena Managers Association to provide training opportunities that deal with testing and air quality monitoring. So my reading of this, even though we're a large agency and we have specialists that do this, but my reading has been that the Minnesota Ice Arena managers would work with the Department of Health to put together a training program that could effectively address the issues that are enumerated in this bill. So that's how I would see the testing or the training occurring.
Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson.
Sorry, I'm just losing my train of thought here.
Well, I think the next motion that would be in order, Senator Anderson, would be for somebody to move the A-10 amendment. Yeah, the author of the original motion has left the committee, so we need another
Madam
author.
Chair, I'd move the A-10 amendment.
Senator Pretner Solon moves the A-10 amendment.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
Is this as amended? Or
well,
is it
we need another amendment to amend it, the A-12 amendment to the A-10 amendment.
Okay. I'll wait then.
Senator Pretner Solon.
Madam Chair, I move the A-12 amendment to the A-10 amendment.
All right. Now we have Senator Anderson's latest proposal before us. Senator Olson.
I don't think I can make a motion to amend an amendment to an amendment, can I?
No, we would have to vote on the A-12, then you could offer another amendment to the A-10. Is there any further discussion on the A-12 amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
This is the A-12 amendment. Can those in favor raise their hand? And opposed. The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to now offer an amendment to the A-12 amendment to the amendment on line 1.14. I would like to move to delete that line, which would have the effect of reinstating the significantly and repeatedly language. And I understand that Senator Anderson.
What are the words on, what line are you on and what words are you deleting?
What I'm doing is I'm off on the A-12 amendment on line 1.14.
Well, okay.
That line deletes language from line 1.26 of the A-10 amendment, and the language that's deleted is significantly and repeatedly. So my motion would have the effect of reinstating that language. So I understand that Senator Anderson has said that she would work with the department on this language, but I'm just uncomfortable. Not that I wouldn't consider different language if it's introduced on the floor to deal with the Department of Health's issue, but as it stands, if we pass it this way, we could have an isolated incident that has nothing to do with a Zamboni, cause someone to have to buy an electronic Zamboni, which is very expensive. And so I would feel more comfortable putting this language back in and then having you continue to work on with the department on how we could address that. So that's my motion.
Okay, before we vote on this, I think it might be a good idea if we could just get a little bit better understanding of the fiscal note from the Department of Health.
Madam Chair, Linda Bremer from the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you. I gave away my copy of the fiscal note. The fiscal note that you should be looking at now is the 3175-1A, and what we...
Dated April 23rd, yeah, I think.
Yes, yeah. That's correct. And so as was stated, based on the changes that we negotiated with Senator Anderson, there would be no costs in FY10 and or 11, but the costs would shift over to 12 and 13. So move the column from 11 to 12 and 12 to 13.
So in 12, there'd be 37,000, and then
12 would be 126.
Well, does the 137, I mean, does the 37 just go away?
Yes, Madam Chair.
I see. Okay.
Because that was the compliance report that we moved the date back.
All right. So in 12, it'd be 126. And then in 13, it'd be 73.
Madam Chair, also...
I'd just like to get her to finish.
Sorry. Go ahead.
But I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
The 126 moves from fiscal year 11 to fiscal year 12.
Correct.
Then in 13, is the 73 a correct number?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. Senator Anderson?
Madam Chair, I was just kind of remarking quietly here. This bill has been more difficult than my entire budget to try to move forward on, and I really
we
want...
We wish this was in your budget. That's what we wish.
Thank you for your patience. I really appreciate it. I think maybe we should delete the section on training. If that would help Senator Rosen. I just want to move forward the concepts that we're talking about, that we want to have, the best air quality standards that are reasonably achievable with everyone being in incredibly tight budget circumstances. So that's what
Senator
I'm trying
Anderson,
to do.
And that would be in order for someone to move that, but we have an amendment pending from Senator Olson. And I just wondered, will the amendment that Senator Olson has made change the fiscal implications?
And that's just to keep significantly in repeat.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson and I can work on that. We were not sure that those words really added much value, and so we were editing that. We tend to work with the arenas whenever there's a violation, and so in some ways this seemed to indicate is don't take any enforcement action until it's repeated and significant. And we, whenever there's a violation, we do go work with them on their quality.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that, but it seems to me that I don't have very much comfort and will have a difficult time explaining to the arenas in my district that if I've passed a law that says that even a technical one-time violation could cause them to have to buy an expensive piece of equipment that had nothing to do with that violation, then that's going to be hard to explain that they just need to trust the Department of Health, not, to be reasonable in how it's going to be enforced. If we can put language in there to begin with that says, I think what you're saying is you're going to do that anyway, you're going to apply common sense in how you enforce this, that makes me feel better.
So at any rate, it doesn't change the fiscal note in your opinion?
Madam Chair, I believe not, but it's out far enough that it'll be addressed in rulemaking, I believe. So we can clarify through rulemaking what that is.
All right. Any further discussion on the Olson Amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion is adopted.
So, Madam,
are there any more amendments?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out, in regard to Senator Rosen's concern, just remember the department is going through rulemaking right now, and part of their rulemaking proposal is to put training requirements out there for arena operators. So this really is an effort to just try to guide the rulemaking into a way that covers the bases that we think are important. They're going to do it anyway. They're going to do it by including lots and lots of public comment. And they've told us several times, the rulemaking's on hold because of this legislation and the discussion at the Capitol, but that it's been good for the rulemaking because it's engaged a lot more people in the discussion and raised public awareness. And so whatever rules they come up with are going to have to accommodate the concerns of your arenas, the smaller arenas, the ones that really have the least ability to buy new equipment or to change. They don't have a lot of budget. They don't have a lot of facilities. So we can take this out if that would make you more comfortable. I'm fine with doing that. And I know the health department will move forward on trying to make sure that we have good training requirements in place.
Any other discussion? If not, we will need to vote on the A-10 amendment as amended. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. And I chose to hold my remarks until the bill was actually before us. I think in terms of process, we were a little more generous today.
But having said that, Senator Anderson, I am agreeing with you on the premise that we want safe standards in our ice arenas across Minnesota. The concern that I have, and I'm having difficulty not quite understanding, there is a rulemaking process. We're involved in that rulemaking process right now. I wondered if the rulemaking process will ultimately come back with a fiscal note for this division, or if it would be the case that this rulemaking process is happening, it's going to happen with or without this legislation. And so I'm wondering if the tails problem that I'm seeing on my fiscal note is going to happen with or without this bill. Will that become, you know, is that inherent with the rulemaking? From strictly a fiscal standpoint, having nothing to do with the policy, and I have lots of concerns with the policy, but from a fiscal standpoint, I don't know that it's helpful, frankly, to the division to simply take our expenses and just move them down the road. I haven't seen anything around here to indicate to me that the road is going to be any easier next session or in the subsequent session. And so I'm pretty cognizant of efforts that we make to push things out into our tails. And to people from my district and the Amateur Sports Commission, who's in all of our or many of our jurisdictions, to cities, I've encouraged them to provide comment in this rulemaking process. I think that's an appropriate mechanism, and I think a lot could be done. But I'd be interested to know if these additional staff and the additional costs are inherent with the rulemaking process. That is, am I gonna see this in this division with or without this legislation?
Madam Chair, that may be a question for the health department rather than for me.
Senator Anderson, while she's coming up, I think even though we are not a division that deals with education, there is an attachment to the fiscal note by the Department of Education. But I just have to say, if this discussion is going to happen in the full finance committee or on the floor, that I think we would need to understand better when they say there would be costs to 79 school districts that have operating leases for ice time and arena use, and then there would be some other impacts on 21 school districts that own their own ice arenas. So maybe you can think about that for a minute while we hear the answer to Senator Lynch's question.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, I don't think we can assume that these costs will be forced by through our rulemaking. I think that your question was whether or not they were automatic, even if we did the rulemaking. Our issue all along has been we only have half an FTE who works on this, and so one of the things we've tried to do is that's why we push the dates later, so that one person who works on those things, anytime you added multiple tasks, it cost more. We can't, and we also can't predict what's going to be in the rule, because that's a consultative process. But our intent is not to expand the program. Just clarify.
All right. Senator Anderson, do you want to speak to whatever might be happening with school districts?
Well, Madam Chair, this was in the latest fiscal note. We had this. It didn't show any state cost. And
these would be local school district costs.
Right. It would be levy part of their, most of them lease ice time. All I know is that we haven't had a request from education or a referral from the finance committee to education. So I think they were looking at this as very minimal, so they didn't refer it to Senator Stump's division.
Well, we'll act on the health department portion, but I just wanted to alert you that
I'm very aware of that.
It probably would be a concern about that part of the bill somewhere else. Any further discussion? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, on that note, particularly with regard to school districts, I have been in conversations with the Minnesota State High School League, and while they don't appear to be in the room today, I feel like I can say for the record that absolutely the league would have concerns on behalf of its member districts.
So, Senator Anderson, my suggestion would be that you alert Senator Stumpf to this. If this bill passes this division today, he might want to hear it in his division tomorrow morning. Any further discussion? Any further amendments? Is there a motion on the bill as amended? No. We have to vote on the A-10 first. We didn't do that, did we? Mm-hmm. We did. Okay. I'm losing track now. All right. We voted on the A-10. Any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, those in favor of the motion that Senate File 3175 as amended be recommended to pass, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
And opposed?
No.
Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. We appreciate it.
And the meeting is adjourned. I don't anticipate having any other meetings, but there might be. But in case we don't have any other meetings, I want to thank everyone on this division for all of your hard work, and especially in helping me put together a very difficult budget. Thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.